Who knows more about Munster rugby, me or you, Quinny?
Everyone has an opinion, don't they? Some of the opinions are waffle, but I'd like to think I know a lot.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
No better morning to be in when the biggest hurling story of the off-season explodes into our lives. We'll get to Henry Shefflin in a couple of minutes and we'll also talk about Congress, so don't worry. If you've got a view on Shefflin at Galway, we'd love to hear from you. 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number, or you can leave a comment in the YouTube stream. But Cristiano Ronaldo scored a winner last night as Manchester United came back from 2-0 down. Stop me if you've heard this one before. I mean, like, they were awful in the first half. Did create some chances. Did have some very good chances with the last kick of the first half. Rashford hits the crossbar and they could have got a goal that would have brought it back and would have made everybody think. And then it's kind of a scratchy equaliser from one of the causes of the concerns in the first half in Harry Maguire. And then it's Cristiano Ronaldo with a header to win it. It's like, you can't keep doing this, can you?
It's a bit of deja vu, isn't it?
Yeah.
In fairness, all the story, I suppose, there around his signing and that, and you're obviously looking at his age profile and you're thinking, you know, is this a good or a bad move? But he's got Nadio somewhere to holds already, and you cannot, you love the drama, you love the excitement, you love that last gasp stuff. Yeah, they're papering over an unbelievable amount of cracks, but they're getting, like, that was a big result last night.
Are you a United fan?
I am not. I'm only a casual enough soccer supporter, but I'd be Liverpool if I was to nail my colours to the mast.
Right, well, I wonder what it must be like to be a Manchester United fan at the moment, where you know that in your heart of hearts it isn't going to go anywhere. That, like, this is a fling, but it might also be the most enjoyable fling you've ever had in your life.
Yeah, we've probably all had one of them, and they are quite enjoyable. And I suppose for him to come back for this kind of second coming, like, it could rarely have been, you could rarely have predicted how dramatic it would be in such a short space of time. The amount of things that have happened already, scores on his debut, how many late winners have we had, and we throw in even the two goals against Ireland as well. It's been a fairly jam-packed couple of months for him.
Yeah, as a Manchester United fan, you prefer a little bit of that, you feel alive. I mean, you have all the emotions in the space of 90 minutes, which is kind of what sport's supposed to do for you.
Yeah. It was just funny, like, under Louis van Gaal, it was boring. There's no point in saying any different. Under Mourinho, it was better, but it couldn't have really gotten any worse. At least they're drama fueled nights now.
Yeah, there was a bang of flat track bully off the good Ferguson teams, where the league would be over by April. But because Ferguson had had Fergie time at the very start of his empire building, and then they'd had the European Cup win, which comes in stoppage time, anything always felt possible.
Yeah,
there was definitely a period there where it was really boring watching Man United as a neutral just dominate the league when Wenger and when his team kind of faded away, and before Chelsea came, there was just a period there where, like, oh, this is all very easy for them. And there was a bang of that off Mourinho's era, except without the actual success.
Yeah.
They were flat track bullies. They would beat all the bad teams, but they were no good, really, when it comes down to it. This team is no good, really, when you put them up against Liverpool and Man City to win a title. In one off games, it turns out they can generally be quite good against them. But I don't know. I think that, like, if you're a United fan, what more do you want from life?
Yeah, it's hard to know what their identity or their style is, I think, is the real thing. Like, you know, any team can snatch winners at the end of a game, you know. It's probably just maybe, I don't know, it's just a bit of probably perseverance and the class, like, they've obvious class. He's just wondering, what is their style of play? Is there any great system to what they're doing? And to be honest, it doesn't look like there is, in particular in comparison to the other big sites.
It's funny you bring that up, because that was there was a piece in The Athletic this week where the coaching staff have heard that narrative and they're pissed off about it because they think there is a style.
Of course.
They're not getting any credit for their style. So actually, we'll talk about that with Andy Mitten a little bit later on. I'll tell you what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock, because we may as well get into Henry Shefflin at this point. It's 7:34 a.m. You're watching OTB AM. I'm going to bring you Andy Mitten at 8 o'clock. We're going to speak with Aidan Fogarty at 8:20. We've got our Magic Wall update with Will O'Callaghan, aka John King, at 8:40 to show you how the swing states are voting. You votes overnight from the north, you can guess what colour they are. Stephanie Roach, 9 o'clock. Phil Egan at 9:15, talking about some transfer gossip. We'll bring you more Henry Shefflin reaction from Cyril Farrell at around about 9:30 this morning. But let's get into this. This is a bomb going off in the hurling world yesterday. It's like, John Fogarty was the first person I saw tweeting, and I was like, what?
Yeah, no, you couldn't have seen this one coming, really. There's kind of been a theme amongst a lot of the big jobs in the GAA recently. When they have somebody else, that they're lining up or nearly ready to bring over the line. I think they're happy to have other names circulating in the media. It was quite similar in Wexford. Darry Egan was mentioned down towards the bottom end. It was more, you know, would Jason Ryan be taking over the hurlers after being with the footballers? Derek McGrath was in the conversation. Several other names. Eddie Brennan was in the conversation. And then almost, it's kind of left field almost with Darry Egan coming in. This is definitely left field. And obviously, it was circulating on Tuesday that Davy Fitz was going to take over with what looked like a fairly banner-heavy Clare backroom team, which made me a slight bit suspicious because, you know, they're always going to want at least two or three of their own and guys with fingers on the pulse. So it's kind of suspicious of that. And then it kind of got word of this yesterday afternoon. Hard to firm it up as it is with these things, particularly when people aren't answering their phones. But then it was obviously confirmed last night. And this is just, I couldn't have seen this coming. He was one of the names mentioned in 2019 when Shane O'Neill got the gig. He was obviously Ballyhale manager at the time. He's Thomas Town manager at the moment. For his first foray into inter-county management, to be with Galway and it to not be against Kilkenny, and the fact that you are guaranteed that you are playing Kilkenny next year. There's no like random draw next year. They will play them in the round robin stage of the Leinster Championship, and there's a likely chance that they will play each other in a Leinster final, and he would come up against Master Cody, who he won 10 All-Irelands with, who is, Shefflin is the embodiment of that Kilkenny team, you would say, and he's going to come up against his former master now, and it's going to be so interesting.
Cyril Farrell had a great line last night where he was saying, obviously the first time I saw Henry Shefflin was when he was playing for Waterford IT, and it wasn't even, I was like, who's this lad? He was on Taking Freeze, and it's that career, that kind of self-made aspect of his career as well, that not just the skill and the ruthlessness that defined that Kilkenny team, but the fact that he was his own man as well.
Yeah.
Like, so it was Cody's team, but they were all their own men. Like, as we get to know them, particularly after they retired, there were no shrinking violets. There was no kind of like, oh, they were all whipped into shape and they all did what Brian said. They kind of actually all did what they wanted, and it just so happened that they all had the same mindset.
Yeah, Shefflin is an interesting one. As Cyril said there, Shefflin was a, you know, Kilkenny minor footballer, and he basically turned himself into a, I would say, an athletic freak, and worked unbelievably hard. Everybody works hard, but I would always say that, you know, Seán Shefflin's best strengths as a player was his tackling ability, his ability to keep the ball in the opposition back line and make it unbelievably hard for defenders. He worked so hard. He set the tone for that Kilkenny team, I would say. Eddie Brennan was obviously on last night as well, and he said, he mentioned that, and I've heard him saying it before about Henry was going to be missing the Friday night of the Friday night before some big game. So he was there the Tuesday night and basically left them all with a distinct message that, you know, I'm not going to be here Friday night, essentially said, to, you know, rile you up or get you ready. So you have to be ready yourselves. I'm going to be ready. Are you going to be ready? And I suppose it's that kind of mindset that he has clearly brought to management already. Look, you have to say as well, this is like Henry Shefflin, the greatest player we've probably ever seen, 10 All-Irelands, 11 All-Stars. He's only managed for 3 years. It was a 17 game unbeaten run, I think, with Ballyhale, successive All-Irelands, and he's with Thomastown now, who've already won a league and are in an intermediate semi-final the week after next.
Yeah.
And it's his first foray into inter-county management now. So it is a bit of a departure for Galway to take. And funnily enough, this is the third time in a row, Micheál Donoghue, Shane O'Neill and Shefflin, where they've taken a punt on an All-Ireland winning club manager having their first go at inter-county management with them.
It's really interesting. It's interesting on so many different levels. The fact that he is actually not very experienced at this level, and this is such a big job at Intercounty, because we had them penciled in since they won the All-Ireland as one of that three teams who are most likely to be able to challenge Limerick and put it up to them physically and have the skill set and have the strength and depth. And so therefore, like, it's an amazing job if you can get everything right.
Yeah.
But equally, it's a high wire act, because if it goes wrong quickly, it goes wrong quickly.
Yeah, and as well as that, he was over Ballyhale. He knows Ballyhale intimately. He knows the players intimately. His nephew's on the team. He's heard with TJ for years. He's heard with Colin Fenley, Michael Fenley, all these guys for years. He's going to neighbouring parish in Thomastown. He knows them well. I'm sure he's studied them closely. He's going to Galway now, who he's been studying from afar, I would say, in his role as a pundit with the Sunday Game. But he's also going to a county that have won 5 of the last 7 minor All-Irelands. He's going to a county that won an All-Ireland title as recently as 4 years ago, and fair enough. And this is another question obviously that need to be asked. Their best player of all time, probably Joe Canning, has exited stage left.
What would you do?
Well, I'd be amazed if a conversation doesn't happen, but we talked to Joe on the throw-in there about 2 months ago, and it seemed clear that his decision was well made up, and that there was no turning with him. But like, it's going to be the best player of all time talking to potentially the second or third best player of all time, trying to coax him back to see if he can bring something to the fold in Galway. I personally don't see it happening,
right?
And I think Joe has stepped aside now. He turned 33 earlier this month.
From Sheffield's perspective, is there any benefit in him not coming back and saying, actually, it's a clean break and I have a little bit of transition period? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, it's a double-edged sword. You bring him back and you go, you got the band together for one last court, and that's this year, and then that gets you to a point where you're competitive immediately because there's like this mad hype, and then slowly underneath that, actually what you're doing is next year is year two where you know everybody intimately, and Joe steps away because he's only back for 12 months. Like, I see all of these scenarios as potentials.
Yeah, it's a short term. I suppose getting Joe back would be a short term solution. Like, his legs have definitely not been disingenuous. His legs are on the way, and he's getting a bit older. That's just only a natural thing. And you probably say, you know, the best hurling he ever done with Galway was probably 17, and even 18. I think he was even better form over the last couple of years. He's just had an awful lot of injuries. He missed Portumna's game at the weekend, even with an injury as well. So if he does come back, it would probably be a stopgap for a certain amount of time, and it would probably be a leadership role, I'd say, maybe more than anything else, and potentially, you know, an impact sub. Whereas I'd imagine Shefflin is not looking at the medium term because you don't know how long he's going to be there, but it's 2 to 3 years really, and it's trying to build something during that time.
Yeah, okay. So we're going to have Aidan Fogarty with us at 20 past 8 this morning. We were in touch with Michael Fenley last night to see if he would be free to come on, and he was like, no. But he did tell us that we could quote him on this. It's a big win for Galway, and Henry has never been afraid of taking on new challenges. The extent of the travel commitments shows his intent on bringing Galway to a new level. I had to map it, so I don't know exactly where Henry lives, but like mapped from Kilkenny and I mapped from Ballyhale, and it's like 2 hours or 2.5 hours. If they're training in Galway City, it's 2.5 hours. If they're training in Ballinasloe, it's still 2 hours there and 2 hours back.
Yeah, it's a nice spin. There's no point in saying any difference.
And it's not motorway the whole way.
No, they're bad roads. Anyone that's travelled those roads knows that they're bad roads. Just a quick one from a Galway point of view. I would say the talk around Galway had been pretty toxic, I would say, in the past 3 or 4 weeks, and there was not a good mood around the place. And I know you're a Kildare man. I think this appointment has had the same effect as Glen Ryan coming in and his All-Star team has had in Kildare.
Can I actually, the parallel for me is McGeaney. The parallel is McGeaney arriving in Kildare, where there's this like, whoa.
Yeah.
They're like, whoa. What?
Yeah, total ball from the blue, yeah.
And it's like, I think that actually really worked. Kildare were on TV all the time. If you listen to the football pod of Paddy and Andy, McGeaney actually was very clever as a... We just didn't get the credit from the Kildare clubs who kicked him out on a stupid vote. Not that we're bitter 10 years on. But it was that kind of sense of like, here's a legendary totemic figure from outside coming in. I think the point you make about the toxicity disappearing is also true. So it's double whammy. It's like... yeah, it's amazing.
It's just optimism is sky high within Galway. I didn't see any negative coverage, I'll put it that way. Like, because people are so surprised. Like, at the end of the day, fair enough, he's only managed two teams and he's in the third year of his managerial career at the moment. But it's Henry Shefflin. It's the greatest player that's ever played the game. And it's like, the way I'd equate it would be, it's like, you know, a two-year-old horse who has produced this unbelievable form. And you don't know what he could be. Could be anything as a three-year-old, he or she.
Yeah.
Shefflin could be anything as an inter-county manager. He could be. The world is his oyster at the moment. And the fact that he has the belief in himself to go somewhere where he's going to be the centre of attention, he's going to be coming up against his own, I think it's a fair statement from him as well.
Yeah, it's ballsy.
Yeah, and big time,
You know, he could have taken a tier two team, he could have, and got like, okay, this is how I put it together, this is the level of commitment that I need to make, these are the issues that some players will have and not give me, and that would have been an opportunity for him to spend time looking at the playing stock of other counties. But no, it's like, big job, thanks very much, I'm not messing around here.
I think he's all to do with all about timing. Like, he wasn't planning on taking over Ballyhale. They had just, for them, they had gone to a low ebb. They'd been beaten in a county semi-final, and he wanted. Yeah, I know, that's for any other club, that's a normal thing. And he thought they were underachieving.
He was right, though. In fairness,
he was definitely right. And by all accounts, like, with the talent that they had available to them, yeah, it's an unbelievable talent that they had. But there was plenty of little things going on in the background that he had to iron out and sort out, and he clearly did, because he got the best out of a brilliant group. But when you have lots of really good players playing like that, there obviously are egos and there could be issues there as well. there didn't seem to be any issues when he was there.
Well, it's the thing about Jim Gavin. No, he took over a successful team, but he turned them into a machine and dealt with all of the egos and dealt with all of the trouble that comes with that, that nobody ever gives you any credit for. But actually, when he steps away, you begin to see, okay, well, he's clearly had a lot of stuff going on there. And like that with Shefflin at club level, the one thing you would say is that because of the talent pool they had, once you get everybody in, your man management is good, maybe the tactical side of the game is less important than it will be when you're coming up against Paul Kinnaird's Limerick, for example, at some point. So that's the next bit of this. Who fills up? Maybe he is a tactical genius. I don't know. We'll wait and see. Like, he could well be. But that coaching ticket needs to be as impressive and aggressive and, you know, forward thinking as what he's up against at the moment.
Yeah, Richie O'Neill, who he has with him, he's been with him. He was with him for the 2 years, I think, in Ballyhale, and he's with him in Thomastown at the moment. His brother Tommy would have been with him as well. He's in with the Kilkenny Camogie team, I think, at the moment with Brian Dowland. So it's going to be interesting to see what the local angle is with them. There's plenty of good coaches there. It's a matter of you're not going to get much credit. It's like Shefflin is going to get all the credit if they win. That's just the way it is. And he's probably going to take all the blame if they lose as well. So I would say whoever he brings in with him, we're definitely going to have to be short on ego, because they won't be front and centre. Henry's going to be front and centre.
I don't know the coaching scene in Galway well enough, but that team that won the All-Ireland, there's a few of those who are coming to a certain age who you could put in that backroom team, which would be an immediate connection. Obviously going outside was something that the county board wanted to do. It seems like they did want Micheál Donoghue, and he was just unavailable for personal and business reasons, so that's fair enough. But after that, this is the next best thing. The other thing is that the appointment of Davey, which had been mooted, whether or not it was real or whatever, it certainly did draw some fire from people in Galway who would not have been happy with that. That's gone as well. So the kite got flown, people saw what the response was going to be like, and you went a different way. There's definitely a shrewdness in that.
I think there is, yeah. And the fact that they were able to keep it as quiet as they kept it is extraordinary, really. You're talking to, as you said, you know, the best hurler of all time, and you managed to keep it under wraps until about 4 or 5 o'clock yesterday, which is outstanding, really. The Davey thing as well. Davey is obviously, like, his record speaks for itself. Like, he's brought success everywhere he's gone, be it the Munster title in Waterford, the All-Ireland in the league in Clare, and obviously a Leinster title in Wexford as well. He probably does divide opinion, and there was I suppose the fact that Clare and Galway are obviously bordering counties, the fact that it looked like the management ticket that had been floated was very Clare heavy. Like, to be honest, I don't buy that. If he got the job, that was going to be his managerial ticket, because it can't be. You have to have local eyes.
Yeah.
And they weren't just going to give him carte blanche. But it's going to be interesting to see who Henry brings in with him. The likes of, just names that would come to me would be probably someone like Kevin Lally, who was over St Thomas's for a few years, Gavin Keary, who was with Clare a couple of years ago, and I think he's from Loughrea. There's a lot of good coaching talent there.
Could, if you were the Galway County Board, could you put somebody in from the underage structure and say, look, we know, Henry, that this isn't a 10-year deal. You're going to be here for a couple of years, and we'd like our next manager to be embedded. Now, those situations never work out very well because it's an arranged marriage, but Henry, is there anybody in this here sphere who you might be interested in working with, whose ideas you could listen to and could be a sounding board for you?
Yeah, possibly so. And I'd imagine Henry has built up relationships with players from Galway that he played with down through the years. One that springs to mind from reading Henry's book would be, and you have a famous incident with Greg Kennedy, I think, in the 2001 All-Ireland semi-final. Basically, Greg was using some of the dark arts, and I think he taught Henry a very, very valuable lesson that day. Greg's obviously from Loughrea and has been involved with Dublin as well. That could potentially be someone. Wouldn't be, you know, that surprised if someone like Ollie Canning was brought into the equation as well. Guys that I'd imagine he has formed relationships with Galway players that he would have come up against in the last, you know, 15 or 20 years, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if one or two of them are in there with him.
I presume the TG Carra cameras are now suddenly down doing the intermediate hurling semi-final in Kilkenny next week.
It's
one of the most interesting games in the country.
Well, it was going to be interesting anyway, because they're coming up against Owen Murphy's Glenmore and JJ Delaney's Fenians are in the other side.
So you could do a double header.
Yeah, so it could be potentially JJ versus Henry in a county final. So
JJ playing in the forwards or just scoring heavily? What's the...
No, he's up full forward. He scored 1-2 the last day. I think he's 39 now, and we all know him. I was only saying this the other day. We all know him as the, you know, the fullback or the wing back who comes in from behind and cleans house and catches ball, but he's probably doing the opposite now, and he could be potentially being bullied as a full forward, but he's obviously getting on fairly well.
Where do they train? Where do the Galway hurlers train? Do you know that?
Is it? They could train between Ballinasloe, Athenry. They wouldn't train in Salt Hill that much, right, to the best of my knowledge, because geographically, like, there would be very few of the hurlers that would live close to Salt Hill in around
the
city.
Actually, it's the near side of Galway. If you're selling yourself and they say it's only an hour and 50 minutes.
Yeah. I suppose anything that would, I'm sure that's probably all been discussed with Henry and with all the Galway GA chiefs. But it's going to be interesting. They have plenty of time to make calls, plenty of time to think, maybe plenty of time to take calls from journalists maybe along the way to do bits of interviews and bits and pieces. Anthony Daly used to be great for that on his commute from Clare to Dublin back in the day.
Hopping balls.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure Henry is his own man too, so I don't, you know, he would take counsel from people. I imagine Brian Cody would have been one of the people he would have taken counsel from, so that's not going to happen now. It's going to be like, that's just going to be, they could meet in the league. I don't think they will, actually. I think they're in opposite sides of the league, but they're definitely going to meet in the Leinster Championship, and that's box office
immediately. Like, yeah. the Leinster Championship, definitely the poor relation over the last number of years. We all know it. There's no point in lying about it. But all of a sudden, it's like, oh, hang on a second. We've got to watch this.
Yeah, we love a good sideshow. Like, it's hard to beat something like that. And it's something that you never would have thought would happen. And again, Henry's first foray into inter-county management could have been forced somewhat. He probably does want to get experience. He probably does want to be Kilkenny manager. That vacancy is not open at the moment, so maybe you have to look elsewhere. It would be disingenuous to say that this would be an apprenticeship of sorts, but it would definitely be a big learning ground.
Yeah, well, it's not. It's like it's a legitimate opportunity to win All-Ireland.
Yeah, big time.
And could you say it's a better opportunity to win All-Ireland? Are they closer as a playing stock than the Kilkenny team at the moment?
If you look at the underage talent, you'd have to say so. As I said, five of the last seven All-Irelands is still, like, I'm just going through it, like, still, like, Dotty Burke is still coming into his prime. Conor Whelan's still, you know, early to mid-20s. Brian Kincannon is still early to mid-20s. They have loads of talent coming through. Just the wheels kind of came off last year. They had a brilliant league. They were dismal against Dublin and one of the worst first halves in championship history against Waterford. So it's going to be real interesting. The talent is there.
Yeah.
The talent is definitely there. It's just a matter of flakiness. I don't know about flakiness, but what we would have said about Galway, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, that you don't know what you're going to get on a given day. Last year was the first time in a long, long time that was the case once again. So it's going to be interesting to see if he can iron that out.
And that is the exact opposite of what Shefflin was. You always knew what you were going to get.
Pretty much, yeah. The consistency was always there. You knew you were going to get 8 out of 10 every day.
Yeah. OTBAM live in association with Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to move on to a special congress because big developments in the last 24 hours. We had the Director General and, of course, the President of the GAA out speaking in favour of Proposal B. They're not lobbying on behalf of Proposal B. They said if they had a vote, they would vote for Proposal B. That's what they would do. Here is Larry McCarthy speaking with Owen Sheehan at Croke Park yesterday. Have a listen.
Did you consider coming out at any point in the last couple of weeks to throw your weight behind one of these proposals?
No, we didn't. I mean, we were very, very happy with the way the discussion went. We launched the information through the provinces a number of weeks ago. Then we sent out the videos, you know, to all the clubs. So the discussion was ongoing and that was excellent. And then we just decided in a pre-Congress briefing we were asked the question, we answered it today.
Is the general sense in the corridors of Croke Park that people do want to see Proposal B passed?
I can't answer that because the corridors of Croke Park are empty. The building is empty. Tom and myself are of the one voice in terms of that preference. I must admit I haven't canvassed any of the other staff who are around the building, to be perfectly, or either around the building or on Zoom.
Sure. Because there has definitely been a couple of comparisons between how this motion has been debated in public and, say, Pádraig Duffy getting his way behind the Super 8s or Sean Kelly getting behind Rule 42. Was there conversations at all about how much you guys could have done to actually accelerate this thing over the last couple of weeks rather than waiting until today to say anything?
No, there wasn't. None at all.
So Proposal B, then, the main motion that seems to be causing consternation, especially with the provincial councils, is the moving of the provinces to the start of the year. What would your message to them be, those people who are concerned about their provincial championships potentially losing importance?
Well, what I've said all along is that I would like us to be bold in terms of what we're doing, and that's one of the options. you know, the moving of the championships. The championships will stand alone. I mean, in 20 years' time, when you look at the record and you'll see that Tyrone, for instance, maybe win the Ulster Championship in 2022, nobody will know that it was played in March or April, vis-a-vis June or July, for instance. You know, it'll stand on its own merits, I think.
We were speaking to Michael Reynolds from Leinster Council the other day, and it's interesting getting that perspective, because I think there's an understanding why Ulster Council want to protect their championship. Mm. But from Leinster's standpoint, why do you think there's such a digging of the heels in to try and maintain their provincial championship, when we've seen over recent years that that provincial championship really hasn't done anything for the GEA?
Well, you ask Michael. Michael is the secretary. I have no understanding of why Michael might be digging his heels in the context of the question you're asking me.
In general, then, theoretically, why would provincial councils be trying to protect their championships? Is there a sort of power situation going on here?
No, there's not a power situation going on at all. I think just historically they have seen that the championships have been the way that the All-Ireland Championship has operated, and it's changed, you know, and maybe people are not embracing the change. Perhaps they're not being bold, like I hoped that they might have been when I made my comments at Congress last February.
Right, so that's the president of the GAA coming out in favour of Proposal B and asking for people to be bold when they're making their decision. What's your read on this now as it stands?
Well, I thought some of his most interesting comments were around the provincial championships, that the time of the year didn't matter to him and it was still going to be down in the record books as, you know, Dublin were champions in 2022 or whatever. He didn't see any, he's definitely clearly pushing to county delegates and chairman and everyone else, and even the Leinster Council and all the other provincial councils, that the provincial championships are still very, very important, even if they're not front and centre in the middle of the summer. Now,
can we tease this out just for a second?
Yeah.
Because one of the main gripes that is coming from the provincial councils and from people who are against Proposal B, they keep saying the provincial games are going to become pre-season and they're going to be played in the worst of the weather in February, March and April. Right? That's when we have the National League at the moment, right? And they're comparing the attendances at the O'Byrne Cup with the new provincial championship, which is actually going to be played at the same time as the league, instead of comparing the attendances with the league, right? Which would be the first thing you should do, is compare apples with apples and oranges with oranges. But we're not doing that. We're like, no, O'Byrne Cup. McKenna Cup games frequently have like 8,000 or 9,000 at them because people are starved of inter-county action. That's the first thing. The second thing is, at the moment, we play that competition with the league in that weather. If it's such an abomination to play the stuff in the is the logic not you play your best competition in the best weather?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you're saying about like the attendances. Like, I've been in Croke Park on Saturday evenings for massive attendances for Dublin games, be it Dublin Tyrone, be it Dublin Kerry. I don't see the provincial championship being devalued. Now, whether there was potentially a tweak that you could make where there was an incentive for teams to be provincial champions, as in, I think it was Kevin O'Donovan, you know, proposed it, that maybe that they would get an extra point going into their league, essentially, that it would incentivise teams to really want to win these trophies. Now, I think that would help, probably. I still think teams are going to go fairly bald-headed to win their province. It's like, at the end of the day, the best teams will try and win every trophy that's available. Kilkenny did it under Cody. Dublin did it under Gavin and still do it. Limerick will do it under Kiley. People can say you can play the long game or play possum during the provinces. I don't see that happening. I do not see that happening. The best teams are smart enough to realise that there are, what, 2 to 3 trophies on offer this year. We will try and win them all.
Yeah.
So I don't see the provincial championships being devalued that much. Would there possibly be a way of increasing the value in them? That idea there maybe would help.
My issue with that would be, like, if that happened, then Dublin would start the league already, the championship already a point ahead of everybody.
As a result of a weaker provincial run. That's a fair point too. Yeah.
You know, and like, if you're the team who then finishes a point off 5th or 6th, you're like, oh look, I mean, this is rigged in favour of the Dubs again.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point too. There's definitely probably does need to be teased out a bit.
It does, but I think that they're the type of tweaks I think that you can make when you have a system that is trending in the right direction. At the moment, the system is completely screwed, and we've forgotten that because is actually a couple of months away from the championship, and it's a couple of months away from Sligo being hammered and Leitrim being hammered, and the footballers, you can't travel at the moment as well.
Yeah.
So most counties had their best players available and they all played at home, and still the weaker counties got annihilated.
Yeah, this is the season of hope now. At the moment, you don't think you're going to be beaten by 25 points in a championship match. Now is the time, if we give this a right good rattle, whatever, and then reality sets in.
They should have Congress in July when everybody's at their lowest.
After the first round of championship or second round, I'd say it would be a fairly good idea.
Look what you did. You can fix this, but you chose not to. Look what you did.
Time can be a healer, and you can forget recent events when it goes into the winter.
Exactly. And we all have very short term memories, unfortunately. So how important is it that the Director General and the President come out and say this is the plan?
I think it's very important because, you know, counties that are on the fence, I think of three counties in Munster, I think it's Kerry, Limerick and Waterford, that are all making their decision on the day. So you'd imagine that their decision would be, you know, heavily informed by the power brokers within the GAA. You know, that two of the most influential people in the GAA are given their backing for Proposal B. Now, it's not an overwhelming backing for Proposal
B. It wasn't, was it?
No, but they definitely, it's clear that they think it is the best of the options. And I think even they've probably realised the swell of support that is coming for Proposal B now as well. It definitely has helped. It definitely has not affected the chance of Proposal B getting through. It has only helped.
The one thing you could guarantee the provincial champions a wild card place on the wild card weekend, like, because more than likely it's going to be Mayo, Dublin, Kerry, and a good team from the north.
Yeah, a couple of people in Tipperary were saying that Tipperary still operate the divisional systems within TIP. So if you don't make the knockout stages, but you're a divisional champion in either south, north, or mid, or wherever, you have a basically get a wildcard entry. And if you've been knocked out of the group stages, you still have a chance of getting back in. And teams have, I think, in the recent enough past, teams have won county titles or been very, very competitive towards the latter stages, having been knocked out early, but come through that kind of trap door.
I mean, look, I think they're the type of things that you can fix in year three. It's like, okay, it feels a bit unfair. If Cavan were to do back-to-back Ulster championships and then finish third in Division 4 finish out of the places, let's have that chat. Yeah. But if it's not relevant, if it's Monaghan and they make the All-Ireland quarterfinals every year, if it's Tyrone every year for 3 years, it's Donegal every year 3 years, then it didn't really matter, did it?
Yeah, I think what you're saying there is important, because if you have the right system and you realise that there are faults in it, it's very easy just to make, you know, a subtle change and make sure that this doesn't happen again. But, you know, with the system that we have, like, what subtle changes are you going to make to the system that we have at the moment?
Provincial round robin is the only thing that has come forward that is being lobbied for, like, mercilessly in the corridors, in the backstages, right? That's what they're looking for, because it makes the provinces most important thing forever. That's what that does. It guarantees it locks down that power base forever.
Yeah,
so that's the alternative. Yeah. This whole notion that we'll fix it next week, when the million ideas that everybody has have to be gone through again, and another committee has to be formed to sit and listen to. No, we can't do that. We've already dismissed this. We dismissed this 15 years ago. Like,
yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I've seen that at club level, Ger, I have to say as well, you know, where guys and girls obviously really put themselves out on a limb to put all their energy into this idea, and it's heartbreaking if it doesn't come true. It's absolutely soul destroying, and it's very hard. Those people, it's very hard to have the energy to go again.
They won't.
Yeah, and you have to get new people then to drive it forward. That process usually doesn't happen like over a couple of months. It takes years to get really forward thinking people to come back and, you know, circle the wagons again and come up with this another great idea.
Every 10 years a report comes out about championship structures, and invariably it has been voted down in one form or another. Like,
yeah,
this is it. Everybody's like, this is it.
Yeah.
It's now or never.
I'll give a very simplistic example. In my own club in Burr, there was a committee assembled to float the idea of our lotto going online about 15 years ago. And there would have been maybe an old school mentality that this wasn't for us. And the people, the power brokers within the club shot down this idea. The people who had poured their energy into it got a bit fed up. And then eventually, when the pandemic hit, bringing Arlotto online was the greatest idea of all time. So it took about, could have taken 10 years for that. And that's such a very simplistic idea. So that's how hard it is to affect change.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff. Right. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Andy Mitten standing by. We're going to talk to him about Manchester United next.
OTBAM.
So, which of the three of you is most likely to be the Ireland manager's pet? Write down your answer. Leanne's ready. Megan is ready. Okay.
I'm not ready yet. Oh, I haven't written yet. We both know who it is.
Can't worry about it. Oh, this is obvious, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you can reveal your answers. Who have we got?
Meg. I said myself.
Yeah.
You're all.
I just want some points.
Straight away. I just want some points.
As you said it.
7 minutes past eight this morning. A reminder, of course, Ireland versus Sweden is live tonight on Off the Ball from 7 o'clock. It's in Tala and it's a big, big game from the Republic of Ireland. Sweden, second ranked team in the world. It's all thanks to Sky, proud primary partner and supporter of the Republic of Ireland women's national football team. It is Emma Byrne alongside Nathan in the commentary box for that one. So make sure you're tuned in. And actually, from around about 5:30 on all our social channels, there'll be a roadshow. Adrian Barry will be bringing you all the pre-match analysis to get you up to speed with exactly what's going to happen. We'll hear from Vera Power, and you'll have the whole crappy quiz with three of the Ireland team as well. So it is 8 minutes past eight. Time for us to turn our attention to Cristiano Ronaldo. Andy Mitten, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm fine. Not quite as enthusiastic as your introduction there, but I'll settle for that.
We were talking about this earlier on, right? Being a Manchester United fan right now is what it means to be alive as a sports fan. We kind of characterised it as like this might not be a long-term relationship, but it sure as hell is an exciting fling.
It is. And I was thinking at half time last night, knowing that I was going to speak to you. Oh, no. Well, you've got to do it. You've got to take the highs and the lows. And United scored the three goals in the second half. I thought, OK, I'm ready to talk to yourselves in the morning. And here we are. And it was unpredictable. It was worrying at times last night. I think a lot of people have forgotten that Atalanta are a very competent side. Their goalkeeper played very well. United didn't play that badly in the first half at all. And yet went in 2-0 down. There were a few boos around Old Trafford. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer walked right in front of me. And he sort of gestured his arms to say, I need more support, which was quite a brave thing to do because his side were 2-0 down. And after the game, I asked him, I said, did you panic? He went, no, not at all. But we can't pretend that everything's rosy in the garden of Manchester United at the moment. But people walked out of Old Trafford last night smiling, buzzing. It was a full stadium. The Atalanta fans played their part as well. It was nice seeing them outside the ground, really friendly, mixing. And there was a real sense of occasion. And then I look online and I just see this absolute torrent of touching on hatred and some people calling themselves Manchester United fans who wanting the team to lose because you want the manager to get sacked. And I just thought, okay, you're entitled to your opinion. But the experience at the stadium was completely different. And I've got to say, the fans in the Stretford End were fantastic last night. And some of them were even getting a little bit mocked for singing the name of the manager before, during and after the game. But I know it made a difference and I know that the manager absolutely appreciated it.
Yeah, supporters are supposed to support. That's the whole point. It's in the name.
Yeah, and they did support. And they had some new flags in there. There was a bit of a hoo-ha whether they get in the ground, but that was sorted out. And they had these huge new flags. And I just don't think we should take that for granted because when Manchester United were brilliant for so long in the 90s and noughties, the atmosphere actually slid at Old Trafford. And no one really paid that much attention to it because the team was winning all the time. But it was a huge concern for people who read United We Stand, for example. And the club just turned a blind eye to it. And they got away with it because the team was winning all the time. But what you're seeing now is a really resurgent atmosphere. You've got thousands of young people going to the game together. They're standing with the mates. You're getting standing back at Old Trafford as well at the opposite end of the ground. You've got really good initiatives on ticket prices, taking into account that most 16-year-olds are not in full-time education like maybe they were in full-time employment, maybe they were 30, 40 years ago. And those ingredients all help. of course, results set the mood. They always set the mood. And when Manchester United are not winning, and they haven't been winning, and it's not been good, the results have not been good, the performances have not been good, that affects everything as well. So it was pretty bold for the fans to turn up early last night, be absolutely unstinting in their support. And I spoke to Ollie about them after the game, and he started name-checking them, and it felt like there's a good community there. Even though Manchester United are this massive global club, there's a feeling of togetherness last night. And it's easy to say that the morning after a 3-2 victory. Had Manchester United not won or lost, the mood would become completely different. So we're seeing these swings all the time, which ultimately isn't good enough if we're looking at the bigger picture. But last night, it was a great European night at Old Trafford. It was so exciting, and it was a joy to be there.
Look, that's the thing, right? If you want to look at the big picture all the time, then you're an economist, and they don't call economics the dismal science for nothing. But if you want to be a football supporter, sometimes your team's going to lose, sometimes they're going to win, and obviously you want to win all the time, but that's not actually realistic, despite the way you guys did win all the time for such a long period of time. This is a much more realistic fan experience, and Manchester United fans are going through it at the moment.
For fans of most clubs around the world, not just in football, but in other sports, you don't win all the time. That's not a reality. Teams have to lose matches, whether it's in football or basketball or whatever. And it definitely feels real. The problem you have at the super clubs is that at some point they've been that successful that they've attracted fans who only know winning. So I also see it at Barcelona, I see it a little bit at Real Madrid. They think that's the norm. They think that's how it always should be. But there's not one club in the history of world football who've won game after game, year after year, trophy after trophy. And if they did, that'd be a bit boring. I can see that Bayern Munich are brilliant. I don't like the Bundesliga's dominance. I don't think that's a good thing. It drives me mad because I've never hid my allegiance when Aston Villa comes to Old Trafford and win. But isn't it also fantastic that Aston Villa can come to Old Trafford and win, that you've got that level of competition and you've got to take the highs with the lows. Of course, expectations are higher at the bigger clubs. Of course they are. You look at the players Manchester United have got now. It hasn't been good enough. No way at all. But you go on this ride where you don't know what's coming next. And I quite like that. You know, when United were winning all the time, right? I can remember proper hardcore fans being bored by the brilliance, really. I can remember fans, and have been really revisionist about it now, just being bored with the predictability. I saw it at Barcelona as well, bored by the brilliance. What an incredible, entitled position to be in. But at 2-0 last night, nobody was bored there. People had really strong emotions, and sport can draw that out of you.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic that it does do that. And I'm thinking they're not actually played that badly, but this is dreadful once again. What on earth's going on? And then bang, 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 and everything changes again. And yeah, it was a really exciting night.
Yeah, I think we all watch sport and love sport because it makes us feel alive. And if you're a Man United fan, you felt pretty alive at the end of that last night.
Yeah, and those fans that stayed inside the stadium once again, they were singing to the manager. They were enjoying the occasion. And why shouldn't they enjoy the occasion? And if you're an Atalanta fan, you probably didn't even expect your team to be playing Champions League football 5 years ago. Now you become regulars because you've got a good manager, they've got a good football system, but it's a pretty small city. This is a city which is smaller than Cork, and they're doing really well. And they've got good players, and they were missing good players, and their goalkeeper was fantastic. And I love seeing these different styles of football from teams coming to Old Trafford. Not always nice to watch, but if you're trying to be neutral, when Villarreal came and completely dominated the first half at Old Trafford a few weeks ago, I find it fascinating. And I'm like looking at the players going, ah, that's him. Ah, I knew I'd seen him before. Ah, that's a guy who played for Denmark. And I enjoy it because I love watching football, but live football, when you're there and you're close to the pitch and you've got the sounds and the smells as well, because walking up to the stadium last night, I was speaking to loads of different supporters, people having the pie and the chips, and a policeman came over to buy a fanzine, and the Charlie was selling his flags, and it's real life. And we didn't have that 6 months ago because of COVID, and I don't take that for granted at all. And of course I can put a more optimistic shine on it now the morning after, because Manchester United have won and the group stage is looking far better than it was when we spoke in Switzerland a couple of weeks ago. But that's football. Let's enjoy it.
Two quick things I want to ask you about. One is the team selection last night reflected a little bit, it struck me, of what Solskjaer said in the aftermath of the game at the weekend, where he said we need to go back and look at the entire balance of the team, and he tried to fix it last night, and there was that question about whether or not he would be happy to leave out some of the big names, and so he did. And it obviously wasn't perfect in the first half, but maybe if they defended better from the corner and if Rashford scores, they're actually, it's one all at half time, and that's the way that the game goes. The decision to begin thinking about dropping Pogba and reshaping the team, that shows that they are having the same conversations that everybody else is having about the balance of the team. Was it important? Was it symbolic? Was it the right thing to do? What was your take on that?
There's a couple of things. I thought Pogba did well when he came on. I spoke to him after the game and he was all smiles. He's quite good like that. You know, he doesn't give much away. I think Ollie goes for Fred and McTominay as his insurance policy. He knows they're not the best midfielders in the world, but he trusts them. And if you're going to have all these stellar attackers with loose roles, if you like, then you've got to have a shield behind them. The defence, as you rightly pointed out, were culpable in the first half. Manchester United still conceding too many goals, still going behind, still conceding at set pieces, which is a worry. And that led to Atalanta going 2-0 ahead. But it was a ding-dong. It was like end-to-end stuff. It was really, really exciting to watch. I think he's going to have to drop big names on a weekly basis, whether that's Ronaldo or Pogba or Cavani. Cavani's a huge name. You know, he was the best player towards the end of last season, and he's not been starting, and he come on and he played a role in one of the goals as well. So it's a nice choice for the manager to have, but I still don't think we've seen the sum of Manchester United's parts. They've been pretty underwhelming in most games this season, but he called it right last night. Had you interviewed me at half-time, I might have had a slightly different opinion.
That's fair enough. And look, I think, but if Fred missed, well, it's not quite a sitter because he's Fred and he doesn't score loads of goals. But if he scores, Rashford, you would expect to score the chance just before half time. If they both go in, it's 2-2 and they win this game 4-5-2. And it's like, wow, what an amazing performance that was. And you kind of get over the defensive issues. So I think that we can be prisoners of the now and just react to that. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about was, I think it was you tweeted during the week about how the Athletic piece had kind of riled up the backroom staff, who are annoyed about the perception that there is no Manchester United style, there is no discernible pattern to play, they're not as easily identifiable as the Klopp team or the Tuchel team. Why has this annoyed the people around that coaching ticket and that backroom staff so much?
Because they don't think it's true, and they see what they see as false narratives developing, and they totally understand that fans are entitled to be critical, that fans are passionate, that fans are emotional. They totally get that. A lot of them are football fans themselves. A lot of them are Manchester United fans. And it frustrates them because they can't speak out and they see things becoming cliched and stereotypes. And they're just like, this is just not true. So one line which I wrote, which was picked up on, and sometimes people pick up a tiny bit of a big article, and that can frustrate me as a journalist because that doesn't give a full context, but that was that the coaches are grafting their backsides off, often at a cost to their other life, their family life, their social lives. Nobody wants any sympathy for that, but that's picked up on. And people would actually say to me, they're always anonymous, these people, you've been paid to say that. That's the club's PR in operation. And it's just not. That's me as a journalist with contacts I've built up over 30 years, with people trusting me to talk to me and giving their version of events amid other events and versions counter to that, because clearly the football's not been good enough and conceding 4 goals at Leicester City is not good enough. And that my job as a journalist is to tell the truth. And sometimes in football, there's more than one version of the truth. But you get fans who are very entrenched and unable to accept counter opinions, and that's really dangerous. And that's what you get when the team are losing. So even just last night, I put a picture out of the Stretford End singing. You know, this is the Stretford End. They're singing Ollie's at the Wheel. This is happening now. This is factually correct and legitimate for me to report on as a journalist. And half an hour later, it's like, yeah, they're being paid to say this. They're not singing now, are they? I'm thinking, they are singing now. But do I then engage with someone who's anonymous? You just don't do that. And it's results dependent.
I get that. I think that it struck me, though, that one of the things that had upset the backroom team was because there's an element of perception as reality, as Keane and Neville have said, and the perception is that the team doesn't have yet the style articulated the same way that their rivals do. I think that's probably a fair comment. If the backroom staff believe otherwise, it'd be great for them to actually do a series of interviews and explain what they're trying to do, as European coaches do all the time, as Brendan Rodgers was all too happy to do at the weekend. It would be good for them to come out and say that, I think.
Yeah, but what United try and do and what other clubs do is the manager is the forefront. The manager is the one who speaks. And I speak to loads of people at the club and nobody's coming to me, alarm bells ringing, saying, Andy, you want to dig around this coach here? So let's say Kieran McKenna, because I've seen him criticised. I've spoke to people on and off the record and they basically say he's a very, very good coach. But when the team's not winning, there's scrutiny, and there always has been. And it can be quite dangerous because fans are not watching training, and I'm not seeing disharmony from what people are telling me. Clearly, when players get dropped, they're not happy. That's the same in any football club. But I learned a lesson 20 years ago when we printed that Jim Ryan, Alex Ferguson's assistant, wasn't the man, because that's what fans were saying in the pubs. And one of Jim's best mates came up to me in La Coruña, in a pub, they said, what's your evidence for saying that? And there wasn't any. And now I do get evidence. And people can be very misguided if they start picking out what they think might be happening. It's better to deal with the facts of what's actually happening. And clearly when the team's not winning, there's going to be more scrutiny. I can't see a time where you're going to get the coaches coming out and doing a lot of interviews. They think it should be the figurehead. It should be the manager. But behind the scenes, there is a massive team of people there who are very, very good. They've not ended up at Manchester United by fluke. They've ended up there because they're very good at the job. I'm talking about analysts, sports scientists. And 2 weeks ago, United announced that they're bringing in a data and analyst in a senior position. And I put that out. And the reaction was like, about time, it's 2021. I'm sorry, Manchester United have had one of these departments for 20 years. On that very same day, there was a conference going on in Liverpool where people from Liverpool Football Club were saying Man United started this. But again, it's this backdrop of a narrative of everything's doom and falling apart. I'm sorry, the truth is often very different to that.
Yeah, it's good to be alive, Andy. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Cheers.
Thank you.
Andy Mitten from United We Stand. You can read stuff in The Athletic and ESPN as well. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. A quick look at the sports pages before we get to Aidan Fogarty. Newcastle criticism is mounting as clubs block sponsorship deals. Meath, Clare and Tip are their backing to Proposal B. How a young cricket star in India reimagined himself in Malahide. And no Rovers fans at Daily Met next month, with Bowes disappointed over the tickets. Right. That is actually a couple of days old, so the lead this morning is slightly different. Back page of the Mail is Tribal King, Galway swoop to appoint Cats legend Shefflin. King of the Tribe is the back of the Star this morning. The Examiner, with their arty film house knowledge, have gone with Regarding Henry. Ambitious Shefflin relishing Galway challenge. Viva Ronaldo is the front cover of most of the English papers, to be honest. And a new King of the Tribe is the Mirror. What did you guys go with this morning?
We have here, I think it was Shefflin pips Davy to tribe job in shock at 11th hour. That's my own story, so I won't plug that.
Feel free, plug away.
Yeah, and then on the back of the Sun we had Thank Christ for That. So just talking about Ronaldo as well. But yeah, some day of sport, like Simon Zeebo being recalled to the Ireland rugby squad is like a background thought now. It's background noise at this stage.
When you considered that we had been waiting for ages and ages and ages to see exactly what Croke Park were going to say, and then they come out and it's low key and it's we're in favour of this, as opposed to let's go, let's do this, everybody can everybody can make their own mind up on that. But the Sheffield News actually wipes that from the back pages as well.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Yeah, some of the, like, recent years, off-season has been so entertaining, so draining for journalists, I would say, and GA in particular. There's always something happening. But that's as big as it gets now yesterday when that news hit.
Well, it's because of the... it's the size of the achievements that he had as a player, and then I think just the again the low key demeanour of him as a pundit while at the same time delivering a couple of Club All-Irelands, just like no big deal, you know. With his own teammates.
Just something Andy was saying there is very interesting. Like the narratives that fly around in GA, in soccer, in anything, the stories that fly around that are nonsensical, that have no fact base to them. And Andy is right. Like, if you believed everything that was put into a WhatsApp group, you'd be gone from this profession fairly quickly. Anyway, you have to check it left, right, and centre, and you check it with about 10 different people. Like, and a lot of the time, people just take things as fact. Now, someone throws out something and they take it as fact. My rule of thumb generally is, unless you see it in print in a publication that has a lot of standing, I generally don't believe it. When someone puts something to print, then you can start believing it a bit more.
Yeah, fair enough. Aidan Fogarty's with us. Good morning to you, Aidan. How are you doing?
Morning, guys. How are you?
Yeah, good. What was the Kilkenny WhatsApp groups like when the news breaks that Sheffield's going to Galway?
Yeah, it was actually funny you should mention the WhatsApp groups. During the week, so we have our own kind of WhatsApp group. A few ex-hurlers, JJ and Tommy and Stephen Henry's in it as well. And we put up the Davy Fitz that came across. No, I think he was on the score or one of them things. And we put up Davy Fitz and going to Galway, you know. And we were kind of saying, gee, that's amazing, you know. And Henry didn't say a word. I was kind of waiting to see, because I actually heard it on the grapevine earlier on that he was in contention for it. I didn't know what was going on. And I didn't want to say it to him on the WhatsApp group either. But he didn't say anything. He was cute enough. But yeah, look, there's mixed emotions, I think. For me, there's mixed emotions because it kind of feels like we're losing kind of one of our own, and I don't mean that kind of like it just feels that Galway already seem like a championship contender, and they're just going to gain all this experience, and they're going to gain kind of just a great guy, and I think it's a great appointment from the county board in Galway.
Explain that to us, will you? Because you obviously shared a dressing room with him, less when obviously he wasn't your manager, but it does seem like the leadership that he had was clear, the charisma that he had and the power to get people to produce their best and to work hard was there. Is that fair enough? Was it actually like that? Did he already have a quasi-leadership role?
Yeah, look, Henry just always had, like, he was a brilliant hurler, and I think for hurlers on the pitch, and I've only played with Henry, I haven't been managed by him at all, but I've only played with Henry. And when you see guys playing on the pitch and producing the goods on the pitch, you know, backing up the words in the dressing room, you kind of really stand by him. And I think everything that he won for Kilkenny, he dragged him through league games, he dragged him into All-Irelands, he drew the All-Ireland 2012 on his own back. He's won Hurler of the Year 3 times. He has 10 All-Stars. You know, just crazy amount of accolades to his name. But still, he's one of the most grounded, most honest and most humble guys you can ever come across. And I think that's a great attribute to a fella like that. And I think that's what he's probably going to bring to Galway. He's going to bring just an honesty and an intensity to a team that, you know, that maybe Galway are lacking just slightly. But just on the field, the question was, yeah, on the field, he was just a leader. And he didn't talk that whole lot in the dressing room. But when he talked, you'd obviously listen. But it wasn't about strategy. It wasn't about kind of, we should be doing this, we should be doing that. It was back to the honesty and the work rate. We might be talking about we should be here, we should be marking these guys. You know, even leading up to matches, you'd be talking about different strategies you'd have. But Henry would bring it back to brass tactics and he'd say, lads, if you're not working hard, if you're not making the team kind of pulse intensely, it's not going to happen. You can talk all the taxi and go to the window. So I just believe his honesty and everything that he's done for himself he'll just bring that to Galway.
Aidan, just when you mentioned there about everything he brings to the table, what part of you is worried for what Kilkenny are facing down the tracks from Galway?
Well, I think the actual appointment is actually interesting. I think if a Cork team maybe approached them, or you know maybe a Clare team approached them, I don't think he would have went. I think he looked at Galway and he looked at what they had. And, you know, Henry's no fool either. You know, he was in with Ballyhale, who were a very good team anyway at the time. He's gone into Thomastown, who contested county finals and league finals already. So he sees potential in a team and he goes to him. Now, the thing with Galway, I think they play kind of like the way Henry would like him to play. They have big men and very mobile men in the ranks. So they like the Cooneys down the middle, the Burks and all that. And then they have like the Concannons and things on either side. And I think Henry, the way he kind of plays the game is kind of a traditional sense, but his use of the ball is so important. And I think he's seen that with Galway. He's seen potential there. He's seen how probably they played this year and how they kind of, I suppose, maybe let themselves down in a way. They didn't turn up at all. And he just sees a massive potential that Henry can bring to it. And I think the style of the team and the way he plays, he still likes the long ball. He still likes people to win their own ball. And Galway seem to kind of do that and have the potential in players to do that. So if there's another team, I don't think he would have went. But I think he just sees that in Galway.
That's pretty interesting. So, like, if we all have to remember that the thing that anybody who's getting involved in inter-county management has to believe at the start of the season is that they can beat Limerick. Because they're like Dublin were the challenge for everybody. Everybody had to come up with a style to beat them. You can't copy Limerick. You can't do a kind of facsimile version or a scanned version in. You have to do something completely that's your own identity that everybody believes is going to be a winning game plan. Can Galway do that?
Well, I tell you what, when you look back, when were Limerick last beaten in a meaningful championship game? They were beaten by a Kilkenny side in 2019. That you'd say, could you see Galway replicating what Kilkenny did that day? You could. And they have the class then as well. They have, in my opinion, they probably have even more class just as regards of the underage talent they have coming through. But Aidan, that's an interesting one just on Limerick as well. You don't expect, by the sounds of you don't expect Henry to bamboozle them maybe with tactics. It would be more a mixture of the old school and the new school.
Yeah, for sure, lads. Henry's not going to complicate things. He's going to bring in professionalism and all that to it. And that's standard in this day and age. Like, everyone's going to bring in professionalism to it and all that. But I think, if anything, Henry is just going to keep it back to maybe just normal, run-of-the-mill, don't overcomplicate things with this Galway team. I think he's going to bring other aspects to it that maybe people might even think about. I think he's going to bring an honesty and a hunger and a work rate to the forwards. Henry has always talked about a work rate out of the forwards. You won't win in Ireland unless the forwards are working. And if you looked at Galway and what they're probably lacking in the last couple of years is consistency, is that real hunger there and that kind of intensity to kind of win matches when they're under pressure. And I think also, I'm talking about intensity and all, and that's, you have to bring that to matches. But there's the other side of Galway, which I feel is kind of maybe people forget about, is the actual enjoyment of hurling. These guys are 20, 21, 22 years of age, up to whatever, 32, 33 years of age. And it's not a professional game, it's amateur. And Henry would have often spoke, and we would have spoke about in dressing rooms ourselves, that maybe on a balmy Sunday night, going out to play, a championship game, or going out even to training, this is what you live for. This is what you have to enjoy. And, you know, reading between the lines, even with Joe Cannon kind of stepping away, was he just feeling the pressure of it all? Was he not enjoying the game? So I think Henry's going to bring that aspect to it to a huge extent. Bring these guys in. Lads, you have to enjoy the game first and then we'll roll on from there. And I think that's one aspect that lads mightn't think that's important, but it's hugely important. And I feel Galway are lacking that.
Yeah, he immediately becomes a figurehead and takes a bit of pressure off any of those young fellows. If there's a mistake, he comes out and says, that was my mistake. You know, he's able to do that. The one thing I'd say about the inconsistency is that it seems as if that inconsistency can happen when not everybody agrees or is fully au fait with or fully understands or is fully indoctrinated in what the plan is. And it sounds like what you're saying is that there'll be a straightforward plan that's explained, repeated, and so everybody knows what their role is. Do your job, as Bill Belichick would say. If you don't know what your job is, you can look a little bit confused.
Yeah, absolutely, Jared. I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think Henry's going to go up initially and probably won't say anything for the first couple of months. You know, obviously he'll have his talks and things like that, but he's not going to talk about tactics. He's going to strip it all back. He's going to take everything out of it, take all the complications out of it, and just train like a normal kind of amateur team trains. And then he's going to bring intensity. He's going to bring the work rate and bring a hunger and make lads want to come to training and compete against each other. Like, there's so many aspects to this Galway job now. Like, he probably needs to find a couple of more guys as well. So he's going to need a Galway figurehead in with him. Someone who's level-headed, who's not involved maybe in the club scene, as in, you know, has talks or has players themselves that he knows on the club scene. Someone just totally out of it, but knows his hurling, and going to have to bring that into the panel and compete against the older guys as well. There's a lot of guys there maybe that are thinking, you know, have I enough of Galway hurling? He won't want them to go either. But yeah. He wants to bring them all in together on the first year initially. And then come championship, he'll start talking about his game plan. Now, I feel, now it's easy to talk because it's Limerick are winning and everyone looks at the team that are winning championships and stuff. But I have a feeling it's going to be similar to the Limerick tactics. It's going to be the work rate, but it's going to be a long ball to the square as well. It's going to be the use of the ball. Henry always talks about the use of the ball, intelligent play, intelligent hurlers. And Galway have that in abundance. And it's exciting times for Galway. If I was a Galway hurler and if I was thinking about leaving, I probably wouldn't leave. I'd be just interested to see what he brings to it.
Yeah. It is pretty exciting.
Oh, massively. And that's the thing as well. There's that buzz about it in Galway again. They've had a dismal 2021, but lads are surely re-energised by that yesterday.
What do you do about Cian Lynch problem, though, if you're Galway? He must be, like, I understand the pair everything back and make everybody understand this is our plan. But at the same time, part of your brain needs to constantly be going, what am I going to do about Cian Lynch?
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be something that's operating in the background, that they'll have, you know, an idea ready, or, you know, a lot of it is having a player ready that will be able to pick him up and it will be able to take him out of a game. But I think Galway probably did overcomplicate things in recent years. I know they were close to Limerick in 2020, but they were playing a sweeper that just is not, they're not accustomed to that, and it was something that takes a while to bed in, as we've seen with Davey and Wexford. I do expect, as Taggy says, for Henry to strip it back a bit and for it to be a lot more, like, I'll put it to you this way, if they're trying to do what Limerick are doing, they're not going to beat them by doing what Limerick are doing, so they have to do something different. And what Taggy describes there, it may seem a small bit old school, but it's definitely different, and it will be something different for Limerick to deal with next year,
and something I presume that appeals to everybody coming in straight away, and then you layer in your complications as you go, and you know who's capable of actually delivering what you want them to deliver. That question though about how concerned the people of Kilkenny are, you said at the start it's kind of mixed emotions, fear must be a little part of that. What if it turns out that Henry Shefflin is an absolute managerial genius and you never get him back because he spends 20 years there winning 10 of the next 20 All-Irelands?
Yeah, it's a crazy one, but Henry loves Kilkenny. And I think if Henry comes up against Brian Cody, which probably will happen, I don't even know the draw for championship if it's made already, but look, the possibility is Kilkenny are going to meet Galway. It's going to be a strange dynamic, because the two of them have so much respect for each other, and they still have respect for each other, of course. Nothing's going to change there. But it's just going to be so strange to see Henry come up against Brian, who's, I suppose, taught him so much in ways and won so much, both of them on and off the field. It's going to be crazy. But Henry won't want, and I think if Galway beat Kilkenny, Henry won't be jumping inside. Yeah, he'd be delighted. He's a driven, very focused guy and wants to succeed. But deep inside, he'd be gutted that Kilkenny loses. And that's probably the caliber of the man as well, that he's going to, like, he'd stick to his own. I think I seen an interview with Brian O'Driscoll there, they're out golfing, and he was talking about training other teams against Ballyhale, and he just said, look, it didn't have to be gut, but here he is going to Galway now that could possibly play Kilkenny in a championship game. So it's going to be a strange dynamic, but he won't take the foot off the gas. If they're playing Kilkenny, he will want to beat them.
Just on that, Joe, as well, you don't know when the scenario arises potentially for the Kilkenny job to come up. Just hypothetically, if the Kilkenny job came up this time next year and Henry's after, you know, just say he's after winning an All-Ireland with Galway, you know, or he's after getting to an All-Ireland final. Can you leave after 1 year, or if the other job comes up, like he's made a commitment to Galway now, similar to Liam Cattle making a commitment to Waterford?
It's complicated, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, no, it does get complicated. So, like, that's going to be as interesting this time next year or the year after, whenever. It's going to be really interesting to see how he gets on with Galway. And then, if that, you know, the biggest managerial vacancy probably in the history of the GA, if that arises and he's committed to somewhere else, what happens then? So that's going to be an interesting one.
Well, just long term thinking, do you want to be the manager who comes after Brian Cody? It turns out history would suggest you do not want to do that job in any sport.
Yeah, well, that's true too. Desi Farrell, I suppose, came in after Jim Gavin, I suppose, and won All-Ireland straight away. But there's so many. I've never seen anything like the moving parts in the kind of inter-county carousel, the managerial carousel. I've never seen anything like it this year. And this is the kicker of them all to finish it out.
Not to bring this all back to Plan B, but I think that's actually a function of the fact that you have two very competitive championships, and all of a sudden, almost every job, there is a potential for you to turn the team around.
Yeah, no, fair point, yeah, 100%, yeah. And like Taggy said there, like they will definitely play in the Leinster Round Robin next year because we go back to the Round Robin after 2 years without it because of the pandemic. Taggy, how do you see that going? Henry coming up against Cody on the sideline.
Will that be Nolan Park or will they move to Croker?
I'm not, well, they might have to, they might have to move to Croker due to demand.
Yeah, it's going to be about the two managers at this stage. It's not really going to be about the two teams. It's going to be, yeah, it's going to be hard, obviously. It's going to be harder for, obviously, Henry, because he's the one training Galway, supposedly the enemy, you know, and I'm talking to the Kenny man here. You know, Brian has obviously been Kenny for the last 19 years or whatever it is. So, and even on that fact that if the job becomes a vacant, look, you just don't know how the job in Kilkenny is going to go because Brian has just been there so long. And as you said, Ger, is that a poison chalice? If Brian goes, as history suspects, is it a job that you don't want it to do for the first couple of years anyway? But I suspect Henry will train Kilkenny at some stage. But it's going to be a strange dynamic. It's going to be, look, already it's nearly exciting. It's amazing the way just one kind of move in the GA, a managerial thing, can make it exciting, and it's going to be crazy because Henry's learned so much from Brian Cody. He has, and he has said that in the past, and we all have, you know, for leadership, for, you know, for how to pick teams, how to be kind of cutthroat and things. And Henry has brought that even to Ballyhale. You know, he made some really tough decisions at Ballyhale, I remember, for the county final and things like that. And he played with these guys all through his career, and but still had to make him. So he's learned so much from Brian. So it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, that I think it has immediately made everything next year interesting. It makes the league interesting to see exactly what happens and what the level of experimentation is like. We haven't even asked you about Kilkenny. What is the general state of play at the moment in terms of where you guys feel the team is at? And is there anything happening in the club championship that suggests there's some new talent coming through that are going to nail down a place for Brian Cody next year?
Yeah, unfortunately, Gerard, there's just probably not on the club scene. I've gone to a few games myself. And, you know, I suppose looking back over the years, you'd be going to guys and lads would be standing out for their clubs. You know, inter-county hurlers would be standing out for clubs. And rightly so, and they should be, and they should be leading. But it's not really happening in the club scene, as I can see at the minute. Now, there's always one or two that comes through and they just seem to play better for county rather than club. But at the minute, there's not. And there was fierce disappointment after the Cork semi-final last year. You know, we were on a bit of a roll. We were going well. We were a team kind of hard to beat, which are all the characteristics of Brian. And then we kind of just petered out in a semi-final. And then if you look back at it, I suppose we played a Dublin team who were kind of had COVID issues, and we played a Wexford team who could have nearly bet us only for a crossbar decision. So like it's a fine line hurling. And then you kind of say, would we even got a draw in a semi-final if Brian Cody wasn't there? You know, guys are kind of talking, what would happen if he changed it? Lads were saying about the North, about Mickey Hart leaving Tyrone and they went down Ireland. It's a whole, totally different scenario. But I feel we wouldn't have even got a draw against Cork that day if Brian Cody wasn't at the helm, because it was pure determination that got us over the line there. And then it just petered out. So we need to find a few extra guys, I think. I think we need TJ. You know, he's 32 years of age. A lot of the Walter Welch pushing on as well. We need to find one or two kind of speedy, fast and kind of different type of hurlers. I think at the minute, Kilkenny kind of have a lot of the same type of hurlers. We need something kind of different, a different dynamic. And look, we'll have to see in the next couple of months how that's going to fare out.
All right. Well, suddenly everybody's paying attention to everything. Good to have you with us this morning, Taggy. Cheers.
Thanks, lads. Thanks, Milan.
Be interesting to see how that WhatsApp group is pinging along now. After
it's funny because like Eddie Brennan's name was kind of thrown around, and it's like almost Henry was probably happy to hide under the guise of some other Kilkenny player potentially been involved in that scenario. So yeah, it's interesting. Just on what Taggy said there, one player that had stood out in the Kilkenny Championship that could make an impact, maybe not next year but in the coming years, is Keane Kenny from James Stevens. They play Ballyhale this weekend. They were the closest team to beating Ballyhale last year. I think they were beating a point after an epic semi-final. So they play each other again this weekend. And then, obviously, there's no sign of Tommy at the moment, Tommy Walsh, and I don't think that's a coincidence. Tommy's still involved with Tullerone, and they have a massive chance of getting to a county final at the weekend against O'Loughlin's. So Tommy's gone all quiet at the moment, I'd say.
Soon enough, hopefully, we'll hear what all the thoughts are. That group of players now suddenly going and spreading their wings and managing different counties, like the greatest group of individual players we had ever seen until the current Limerick crop, who might be able to knock them off their perch. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's nuts. If you look at, we'd say, two of the best All-Ireland finals we've ever seen are 2009 and 2010, Tip against Kilkenny. Now you have Henry Shefflin, Michael Fenley with Offaly, David Herity with Kildare, Eddie Brennan was with Laois, and obviously have their manager then, Brian Cody, still involved with Kilkenny. On the Tipperary side of things, you have Brendan Cummins with the Tip under 20s, you have Darren Gleeson with Antrim, yeah. You have Darry Egan, who was involved in that squad with Wexford, and I think I'm forgetting someone as well. I think there's four from each side. Like, that's phenomenal. That's eight of the hurling powers that they're involved in. I suppose it's no surprise when Brian Cody scours the inter-county scene, like, he has a connection with nearly everybody he will face.
The coaching tree is long, and its branches are only starting to grow. It's 8:46 this morning. Roy Gallagher is the special guest on episode 24 of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy, available right now in the OTB GA podcast stream. You can subscribe there. Here he is talking about what clicked with Jim McGuinness and Donegal and the importance of Carl Lacey.
I knew myself in the preparation we'd done on the opposition, the way we had our players, you know, geared up for each opposition. I don't doubt Jim knew that as well. But I knew in my heart that nobody else had worked harder than us. You know, it was still at a time where maybe not every county, including top counties, knew what it took. Still at a time where there mightn't be that many. You know, I'm not so sure Kerry people could maybe ask, did they train that hard January, February, March? Not so sure. Maybe Tyrone were at a stage where they're trying to peak. So they were, I think Mayo probably were showing that hunger. Dublin were showing that hunger, probably still had a few issues in calming down the Eagles. So they did. They become a lot, you know. Yeah. Maybe, Paddy, do you disagree? You know?
Hold my hands up there.
You know? So we felt we were such a level-headed bunch of players, you know, and we had a really, really grounded group of players. And obviously Murphy's the figure out of that. But Carl Lacey, Neil McGee, Big Neil, the way he went about that, Ryan Bradley, and the likes of Lacey should have got footballer Barry, an old teammate of ours, hatcheted him in the All-Ireland semi-final, and I don't blame him for doing it, but if Lacey hadn't got injured that day, we could have got over the line. But even at that, I thought he should have got footballer of the year 2 years in a row, which would have been a phenomenal achievement, you know.
He was sensational.
Brilliant player,
wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a sensational player. I don't mind Carl hearing this, you know. I used to think the white boots, Jesus, you know, fancy solos, what's he about? But for them couple of years, Andy, you'd know him, sure, you were at Sligo with him in Jordanstown. The way he trained, he'd say very little. I mean, he just led the examples. Those crazy times where Kevin Cassidy had wanted black books to Neil boys and Lacey look and go, what is he for real? You know, that wasn't Carl's game, you know. The way he trained, the way he applied himself, the way he led, it was phenomenal. And there's a lot made of the Mayo game in 2012. Mayo, in my opinion, made a big mistake letting Alan Dillon play wing half forward on him. And the Carl had roasted him in a league game in Ballyshannon. The two of them were going into a footballer of the year. So the two players, if I was Mayo that day, I was dreading them bringing Alan Dillon into the quarter forward, which I would have done to keep Carl. There's an awful lot made of Murphy's goal. People should see the way Carl got up the field, the quality of the ball into Michael from inside the 45. It was just unbelievable, you know.
But I just remember we snuck into the Kildare game in 11 to watch it.
Yeah.
We were playing Cork. Mad stuff. You'd never do it now. But we went into the Kildare Donegal game just to get used to Croke Park surroundings the night before. The night Cassidy kicked the wonder point. But it was 4-4 at half-time.
Classic.
The only time I seen someone put a man-to-man marker on Lacey.
Yeah.
It was Brian Flanagan. It killed you for about 45 minutes until Flanagan ran out of steam. Do you know?
Yeah.
It was a brilliant move by McGeaney at the time. And nobody did it then after. You must have been thinking, someone has got to put a man marker on Lacey. And it never happened, you know?
It never got to. And it was, you're right. We were struggling for scores. We could barely score. They pushed Brian Flanagan, who was a natural wing back, up on him. And we were going, Jesus, we need to get him in the game. But in a crazy way, I would actually show as a motivational. You can show it to the Leitrim boys now when you get going, Andy. The picture of Carl Lacey after that game, I know we went to extra time. It's the closest to physical exhaustion I've ever seen on a football field. And the amount of times he got double ups, turnovers, blocks. And to me, I don't know who got man of the match. He still ended up probably the man of the match, despite, as Andy says, the first 35, 40 minutes was crazy. And if Kildare regret it, they should have pushed somebody up on him when Flanagan tired again, you know.
Oh, the litany of regrets that Kildare have after that game. But good to hear that Geezer was a genius and then Kildare got rid of him. good move, clubs of Kildare at the time. Anyway, all's well that ends well from that perspective. That's really interesting stuff. Lacey, the genius, the nice guy, but still a genius.
Oh, an absolute class player. Everyone remembers Murphy's goal, but his surge forward and that lovely angle delivery in was beautiful. And as I said, I would have been the same. I'd be very traditional. I'd be all about the black boots and doing as little as possible to stand out. But he was obviously his own man and had
massively. Hang on a second, you're into your wrestling. What?
Yeah, well, I'm not outwardly into it. Do you know what I mean? I try and keep that under a rock somewhere. Not really, to be honest with you.
OTBA was brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, put your best face forward, their new and improved razors. That giggle is the inimitable sound of Will O'Callaghan on Skype, and also with us in studio we've got John Duggan. Good morning to you both. How are you?
Well, morning, lads. How we doing?
Yeah, good. So special congress, we're time for an update. John, the news front of this yesterday came through that Croke Park, the corridors of power may be empty, as we learned from the president yesterday in his interview with Owen Sheehan, but they are putting their weight behind, somewhat of their weight behind, Proposal B.
Well, Tom Ryan, the Director General, Larry McCarthy, spoke yesterday, and Tom Ryan said he didn't have a vote, but personally he said he'd be in favour of Plan B. Larry McCarthy urged people to be bold. I was surprised by this. It was progressive. I didn't see the defensiveness from GA officialdom that I've seen in other commentary. And I was refreshed by it. And that's not because I believe in Plan B, but I felt there was a, well, I would say an adequate and commensurate acknowledgement of the players and the need for change and the desire for change. The most interesting thing I took out of the whole thing was that they assured the provincial councils that they would not be out of pocket for any changes to the structure.
They did say they'd told the provincial council this before. That message doesn't seem to have landed or resonated with the provincial councils, who have definitely been telling everybody, we're going to lose money, this is a disaster, it's the worst plan that's ever been put out there, this is turkeys voting for Christmas, it can't happen. That's the message that has literally been coming from the provincial councils. But Croke Park is saying, no, we told them that there'll be no issue in funding. This isn't a money issue at all.
That's a big argument taken away. So therefore, the argument from the provincial councils is really all about the status and the power of provincial championships. And as you heard from Michael Reynolds, his argument was to bring a round robin into Leinster. And I personally don't see how that could in any way enhance the championship as a whole. So will it sway votes? I don't know. We have, as I said yesterday, 183 votes. 51% of the vote is between Central Council, overseas delegates and past presidents. And the rest is from the counties themselves. And Will has been doing a great job with the John King map and highlighting that there's a lot of support now for Proposal B. Will this make a difference? Like Albert Reynolds went for President of Ireland and Bertie Ahern voted for him in the vote, but he still lost. So we don't know how it's...
He made a point of showing it to him, didn't he?
He did.
That's it. Look, it wasn't me. It wasn't my fault this didn't happen.
Now
I've got your back here, Albert.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Larry McCarthy or Tom Ryan are doing that. But,
I'm just saying that
it's not going to be down to them.
Michael, you probably know this, but Will O'Callaghan was actually an Offaly delegate at... at Congress 2 years in a row. Did you know that?
I actually didn't know that until I saw it on Twitter yesterday. And yet another string to your bow, Will.
Adds a couple at least.
What's the young fella in Sky who's not John King, the other guy who does what should be the off shift but actually is the one that we get to see most of? What was his name? That's who you're the, our version of that.
Is it Phil Mattingly or Mattingly?
Is it?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Well, come on. Show us our magic wall.
Well, look, here's the latest on the magic wall. We had four declarations, Gerard, that happened in the last 24 hours. We've got the first two confirmed no votes. No great surprise there in Ulster. You've got both Armagh and Fermanagh are going to be voting against Proposal B this coming Saturday. They account for five votes, pointed out by many people yesterday, that when we got the full breakdown of the votes, because this is slightly different to Congress, this special Congress, you get effectively half of the delegates that you would normally have at a full Congress. So we got the full breakdown from the GAA yesterday afternoon. As John mentioned, 183. Ulster accounts for fewer votes than the overseas bodies. Whether that's right or not, you can make your own mind up on. But five votes declared now into the no column, which we had none confirmed as of yesterday. I make it that yes has now gone over the 40. because there will be no amendments. That was confirmed by both Tom Ryan and by Larry McCarthy at the press conference yesterday. Laois is going to go green, even though technically they're down as a free vote currently. The discussion that they had on Monday was that if there were no amendments, they would be voting in favour of Proposal B. So confident to give three more votes there, alongside Sligo, Leitrim, Roscommon, who are now confirmed on that block in the corner of Connacht, which will all be voting yes. And Warwickshire have indicated on the overseas side that they'll be voting yes. The only thing is that pretty much every other overseas body is keeping their cards close to their chest. Europe have said that they're undecided as of yet. Both Australia and the Asia bodies are saying that they won't be revealing what way they're voting ahead of this Saturday. So they're the unknowns that are in the overseas. And Central Council is a fairly loose grouping of provincial council members. You've got the GPA included in that 52. You've got other bodies have got a couple of votes in there as well. So with about 40 votes now going towards yes at this stage, 5 confirmed against no. Of course, you've got to get to 110 if this is going to be carried. Oof. There is a lot of votes that still have to be convinced between now and Saturday.
Is it going to be like a Donald Trump coming out here and saying that the election has been won and then the votes will have to come through? And then it all changes over 5 or 6 days. It'd be kind of fun, wouldn't it?
We're going to end up in the Supreme Court, are we?
Yeah. It'd be,
if that's what it needs to be to get changed.
And then there's people coming out like months later and saying, stop the steal. I'm just being facetious here, sorry.
The Central Council votes are going to be interesting because a lot of, within counties like Cork, Tipperary, you're going to have Central Council delegates within those counties. You would imagine that, you know, Cork are voting for Proposal B. So you'd imagine on top of the votes that they have already that their Central Council delegate will
should
be
vote
Proposal
in those.
B. Well, you would think so. If they're Central Council delegate for that county, that's not a certainty. And I suppose what you were saying earlier is about Bertie and Albert Reynolds, we're not going to get that. We don't. We're not going.
Is that a danger? Is that a worry? Everybody can say, and then it's a secret ballot, and then it doesn't turn up. I wonder, are we going to see the actual? You know, are you going to see that? Like, I'm sure everybody will vote the way they're mandated to vote, but are you going to see that afterwards, I wonder?
I find that hard to believe. And you don't know. I don't think anything like that has ever been made public before.
Somebody voting against what they said?
No, like, if it's technically a secret ballot, it's technically a secret ballot. Like, you don't have to make the results known public. But I do think that Central Council one is interesting, that if your county has already given the backing for Proposal B, that would heavily suggest that your Central Council delegate within that county will vote accordingly.
Right.
So in the yes front for Proposal B, there could be, you could be adding the Central Council delegate vote to that as well.
So is that a more conservative body, Central Council? That those 52 votes are can we just take it as an estimate? This is going to be a conservative body. 30 to 40 votes are going to be against this.
I would think more likely to vote no, John, but it is a fairly wide church within that 52. You'd have to think that the 2 GPA votes will go yes. So that would leave 50 up for grabs on Central Council because they're included in that figure. I'm not sure how Rounders, handball, ladies football, Camogie are going to
everybody's
use their
votes. Everybody's got an interest in this
52.
Thing. Everybody's got got a stake, don't they?
So there is an argument that there's a lot of people who don't have a stake in the All-Ireland Football Championship who are going to have a crucial vote. And in some cases, these bodies are worth as much as a county.
Well, so you would hope that yesterday the President and the Director General of the GAA coming out would influence Rounders and those non-counties in a direction. You would hope as well that the international units would be more influenced by those than any other conversation they're having with provincial council delegates or anybody who's in the no camp. Right? That should be the power of what happened yesterday.
You would think so. And I mean, look, the management committee still have, I think it's 8 votes between them as well within that 52. Tom Ryan won't be technically voting on this one, even though he has a sway from, I'm sure the conversations have been happening among the executive of the GAA over the last few weeks about this. And it seemed too that, Jeremy Ryan, when he spoke, the financial officer from the GAA, was fairly clear that they had run the numbers on this and that there was no significant difference between the status quo and Proposal A and Proposal B, that the money would be roughly the same. So if they're very much all on point, then you would think they might be swaying towards yes within the management committee itself. You will have provincial council members who sit on central council too, so they may well count as an extra vote on top of the provincial councils too. So it's amazing how many unknowns we have now. We're going to find out a few more of the counties as well, lads, this evening, including Cavan, which is probably going to be seen as one of those swing states, potentially now sitting in Division 4 of the National Football League, but not that long ago that they were playing in the top levels of the competitions, and we'll see where their two votes are going to go. I think we're expecting to find out more from Mayo and Galway as well. So the bits of white that we have on our current projection map on the wall should be turning either red or green over the next 24 hours. So
I'm hearing bellwether Cavan. That's what I'm hearing. It's a bellwether state.
Well,
you go into the county, you have to go into the clubs and the counties and the areas of Cavan, like
Virginia.
That delegate from Coot Hill is,
He's in favour. He's been in the pub talking heavily in favour of Plan B for about 2 years now, and we all believe him. Obviously, that was a fictional character, just in case it's true. I just want to mention Turlock O'Brien has written a very interesting blog post. He's heavily against Plan B, which I don't really understand, but he does make an excellent point in the middle of it. The bigger questions are the patent unfairness in funding and structures that favour the strong larger counties. That even extends to voting rights. It should be equal representation for counties when the issue relates to county competition. Yes, the larger counties have more clubs and they need to be given proportionate representation when the issue is a club issue. And how can overseas units have so many votes about competitions they have no part in? The voting system is at best flawed. I think everybody agrees with that, right? That there are certain issues that are general everybody GAA issues, and there are other issues that the players should have a much bigger vote in. That I don't know how you come up with a separate voting. Okay, so we do Congress and we do our community initiatives, first part of that, and then the second part is playing rules and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And like, not everybody, like, with all due respect, Will, you as a 19-year-old probably shouldn't have had as much voting power as the players at the time, but you did. You walked into and you pressed the button, whatever, and it was the same vote.
The argument is, though, that within the GA, democracy kind of works from the bottom up, or technically that's what should happen here. So the idea would be that the GPA have been working as a lobby group over the last month, but particularly intensified over the last couple of weeks, where they've been trying to sway delegates within counties, and I'm sure they've been doing some lobbying among those substantial overseas votes which are available too. So the idea would be that rather than them having the direct power of the votes that they would make, that they have to almost work the power through the various different bodies. Like, again, the GA, it loves tradition. We saw just 3 years ago where the idea of transparency on votes at Congress was voted and heavily voted against. And you're never going to see provincial councils and county boards give away that ability that they have to affect change when Congress comes around too. Like, it's like Tom Ryan spoke about this yesterday. He said it's really important that players have a voice in this and that people should be listening very close to them. But I think it's going to be a long time before the GPA gets a bigger voting percentage than they have currently.
It's, I suppose, fair enough on the players, and I think that there should definitely be a conversation about that. But when it's specifically about competition structures for the inter-county game, does everybody have an equal voice in that?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. Like, just a little bit at the end of Dunica Boyle's piece at the Bottom Independent this morning, just said international units from Asia to US have a total of 38 votes across 14 separate counties, and they could be crucial in deciding the fate of Motion 19. They hold 6 more votes than all of Ulster combined. And like, these are international units that, with due respect, do not have a playing interest in the championship that's being voted on.
No.
So that does seem a bit askew. The only thing I would say as well is this special Congress, and especially in recent years, and the fact that we now know how many votes each county has, and you can actually see, you know, where all the different votes are coming from, it's slowly getting more transparent. Because none of that information was out there until recent years.
No, even the number of votes per county. I had no idea that Ulster was less important in Congress in voting power than, and that doesn't make any sense.
Well, Derry has 2 votes and Scotland has 2 votes. Is that the Shinty vote? Asia has 2 votes. Roscommon has 2 votes. So it is. So this is the first time I've ever seen anything like this in a breakdown like this, because we're all interested in this, we're all invested in this as a really seismic thing for the GAA, and therefore we're going to go for the next vote or for the next big issue in the GAA. But what's the story here?
There's 360 in a normal Congress. That seems like quite a lot of votes to try and... Can we get into consensus here? A bit of herding cats going on.
Dublin and the USGAA have the same number of votes. The US have 5 votes, Dublin have 5 votes.
That makes sense.
Larry McCarthy and Tom Ryan did not need to do this yesterday. They could have said, you know what, it's up to the counties. They're the democracy of the association. They can decide on proposal A and proposal B. But they came out and they were progressive about saying that plan B is something that they believe in. And that is interesting. And also that they want to get... I don't know. I think there could be adjustments made if it does get passed on Saturday that would see, especially with Congress coming in February, that it could get it postponed to 2023. But at the moment, it's full steam ahead for next year. I think that'll be a culture shock to a lot of people if it does get passed. People who've not necessarily been paying attention to this.
Yeah, completely. Look, John Horan obviously came out and said he thought that maybe if they postponed it for a year, that would help. But actually, maybe you just get it done.
Yeah.
We live with it for the first year and we go, that didn't
shock
work.
And all.
There's a bit of fixing around to be done here, but let's do it.
Well, if you're looking at the major power brokers, John mentioned Tom Ryan, the Director General, obviously, the GA President, Larry McCarthy, the players, the vast majority of management. If you're talking about the major power brokers and the stakeholders, they're all for Proposal B. So you would think that anybody that's in limbo about what decision they're going to make, that vast majority of opinions going towards Proposal B should swing it in that direction. Whether that actually happens or not is another story, but it's definitely going to be interesting. I was chatting to Cathal McShane the other day and he just kept saying it's in the GAA's hands. I'd love to see this, but it's in the GAA hands. It's definitely getting closer towards Proposal B. Whether it'll be enough or not is another story.
59.47%. You're like, oh my God.
Or 61%, and there's a massive cheer, and then Tom Parsons is lifted into the air.
Now, John, if that happens, there'd be a storming of the Bastille. Will, the other big news that broke yesterday, Henry Shefflin is going to be making the 2-hour trip. You're intimately familiar with those roles. It's not a handy spin.
No, it's not. Kilkenny to Galway isn't exactly ideal compared to some other intercounty jobs that a Kilkenny former player could take up. It's an intriguing appointment, though, because, again, as Mick was saying earlier on, Henry Shefflin did very little wrong at club management. He's been kind of putting a nice little career together. You know, I take Taggy Pogarty's point that he's been clever in the jobs that he's taken so far. We'll see if this is a clever decision to go to Galway, because, you know, as we were going into the summer last year, the feeling was that Galway hurling panel had enough talent within it to have a big impression, and that potentially they could be one of the teams that will push Limerick within the championship. All right, they've lost Joe Canning. All right, there's a lot of miles on some of the players from 2017, but there's still a very talented core group of players who are there. I wonder about him playing a traditional style. That is what he has done at Ballyhale so far, and with Thomastown within the Kilkenny Championship. So I'm intrigued to see what kind of system Galway would use for next season. I think Galway are a team who will probably benefit from the return of the round robin, where they can maybe get a bit of steam before they get to the back of the championship. I expect to qualify for at least the All-Ireland quarterfinals for next season. And they look to put this really disappointing year behind them. How long can Henry wait for the Kilkenny job, or how long will this assortment of former Brian Cody players who are going out to manage, will they have to wait to potentially get the Kilkenny job, I think is the interesting one. I just wonder, and I don't know what Mick feels about this, how long Brian Cody is likely to still be the Kilkenny manager.
There's a question.
Well, the clock has been ticking, but suddenly the ticking is very loud. It's like you're sitting in a room and suddenly you become aware there's a noise. What's the noise? Oh, the clock is ticking.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say on that is if you go back through recent years, they won a league in 2018, they're the last team to beat Limerick, they were in All-Ireland final in 19, they won back-to-back Leinsters. For the resources, I keep saying this, for the resources he has available to him, he's not doing a bad job. He's definitely not doing a bad job. The same resources that were there, you know, in the late noughties, and you know, 11, 12, 14 and 15 are not there. They're just that they're not there, and you have to think whoever the next manager is coming in over the next couple of years, if that does happen, TJ Reid is probably going to be going into retirement. Richie Hogan is leaning towards that as well. So there's two of your finest.
Yeah, so that's why I'm saying if you're Shefflin and you're thinking let one of the other lads take in and bring through a bunch of kids and they'll have 3 or 4 years and then I can go and I've got my experience. Does that not make sense?
Maybe, but if you want to manage your county, I don't know if you think like that. But as Taggy said, he has been not selective in the jobs that he's taken on, but there's been massive potential in the jobs that he's taken on. Galway definitely ticks that box as well.
What if he's unbelievably successful? Like, they might never get him back.
No, potentially not. No, potentially. Yeah,
well, at some point he will do it. But like,
John O'Mahony did his time in Galway as football manager, and then he eventually came home. I could see Henry Shefflin doing something.
That didn't work out so well for Mayo, though.
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose the pull was still there. I feel that there's a few things here. I think Joe Canning is definitely it's a very interesting part of this. Will he persuade Joe Canning to come out of retirement? I know Joe said he was, in speaking to yourselves, Michael, that he was pretty adamant that he wouldn't come back. Henry Shefflin probably is better material at Galway now than he would have if he went into Kilkenny.
That's the point we were making earlier on. It feels that way.
Also, is there a touch of, well, you know, I'm not going to wait around forever, folks, so I'm going to go now to another county. And he's proven his chops at club level. It's not easy to win back-to-back Club All-Ireland titles in hurling or in football. And this is the best player I've ever seen on the pitch. So it's funny, I always felt that Henry Shefflin's Roy Keane and Turin moment was against Galway in 2012. And it's interesting now that he's going to be managing Galway in the championship next year and having shoulders on the sideline with Brian Cody.
Yeah, I mean, like that embrace will be the most spoken about and highly anticipated photograph of the entire sports year next year, guaranteed. Just to reiterate, Michael Fenley, we were in touch with him and we asked him if he would come on. He gave us a quote. His exact quote was, "It's a big win for Galway and Henry's never been afraid of new challenges. The extent of the travel commitments shows his intent on bringing Galway to a new level." So he's not going to cut his teeth or get some managerial chops. He's going there to be successful, and it just injects a level of excitement into the whole championship. So, right, last thing that I wanted to ask you all about is this. If we could stick it up on the screen there, this is is it the second jersey? Is it an away jersey? Is it
Argentina,
third jersey?
Yeah.
It's the new Dublin jersey. It's their alternative jersey. It's now available, and it is the Argentina jersey.
It's gorgeous.
I've always loved the Argentina jersey.
Yeah,
you probably lived in Dublin long enough now to be able to get the passport to be a Dub.
But my kids are getting it. My kids are getting that jersey.
It's very nice.
The only thing is,
go on.
It's very nice. But what's the point in having a sky blue and white change strip when the only reason you're likely to change is when you're playing against teams who are playing in a light color or sky blue?
I mean, that's a good logical point there, Will, but
commercial jersey should be dark.
What's the point, do you think? What do you think? What's the answer to that?
Oh, it'll sell like hotcakes, particularly if Argentina go well in the World Cup next year. Yeah, like, I always thought Dublin should wear dark blue as their away jersey. I thought that was tradition, but yeah, it's as bloody nice.
Yeah, it's sickening, isn't it?
It's also a good thought process fodder for other counties and to be creative with their designs now. Because the best jersey I always thought in Gaelic games is Carlow, because it's a beautiful jersey, beautiful colours and everything like that. But who wants to go chocolate brown now in their away jersey?
Mayo, wait, God, smart. Mayo have a lovely away jersey. It's that black and red kind of mix. It's gorgeous, and it's a big seller. If you go to any of the Mayo matches or you go around the county, you'll always see them wearing it because it's an alternative and a nice strip, and I'd say the same here. That'll sell like hotcakes.
Yeah, there's a huge opportunity for a lot of counties to. But I don't know what the deal is. It might be almost of no benefit to you to be selling loads of extra jerseys because the deal might be that O'Neill's make all the money off them.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, you'd want to get in to see the nuts and bolts of that deal to see exactly what the crack is. Maybe from a marketing perspective, AIG are delighted, and maybe that's what pays Dublin for this. But
Will, do you remember when Offaly released the lovely white jersey in 2000?
I do, which I think, did they end up ever wearing it? I know, like, it wasn't officially adopted as far as I remember.
No, I don't think they ever wore it, but the whole of Borough was walking around in it, I can tell you that.
Was it a Kildare jersey? Is that what it was?
No, it was the Offaly jersey, lads, is the nicest of the nice now. Carlo is nice now. The Offaly jersey.
I'm not a big fan of the Carlo jersey.
Did they not play in white in 1982 against Kerry?
They did, yeah. It was similar to that jersey, that replica jersey that was made in 2000. It was lovely.
Also, in 1991, sorry, Will.
I was going to say it had a crest on the two arms, and I think the design with the crest wasn't officially approved in the end, but pretty much everyone was wearing it that summer when Offaly got to the All-Ireland hurling final, and a lot of people went to the final in white. But yeah, we've had a few white kits since, and the current away is white and very reminiscent of the 1982 kit. But as far as I remember, that white kit came out, sold really well, and eventually they weren't able to wear the actual jersey.
Why not? Who prevented them?
It was something to do with the design, Ger. Again, I'll probably have to talk to someone who was in the county board at the time to find the official reason for it. But I think it had something to do with the design on the sleeves, which they used at the time. And it never got approval, but it went for sale earlier in the year. And everyone had already bought it ahead of the summer. And in the end, it ended up becoming a fashion item as opposed to something worn by the players. I think they may well have worn it in the challenge game, but I don't think they ever wore it in an official game at any point.
Right. It's definitely an underrepresented part of GAA culture. It's starting to come to the point where everybody's like, getting Paul Galvin to design the Kerry jersey was a leap forward, and everybody started to get a bit competitive around it, and that's exactly what you should do, right?
I think down in 1994 against Cork in the semi-final wore the Ulster jersey, the Ulster Council jersey or something like that. There was something unusual about it.
Yellow one.
Yeah. I think there was definitely something. They didn't wear almost like an away jersey.
The Meath-Kerry All-Ireland semi-final, was it 86?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
When they're in Kerry and blue?
Blue, yeah.
Meath
Kerry and blue.
What colour were Meath in? Green?
I think they were in green, yeah. Green and blue, yeah.
I mean, they were cool jerseys.
They were cool jerseys,
There's room here. The one last thing I'd like to just talk about is that there was a brilliant bit of analysis done on Twitter by @BMACAnalyst. Who has mapped out the number of championship games that every county has had over the last 10 years. And it turns out there's, as you would expect, a line that goes from the successful counties down to the unsuccessful counties. And he's also mapped what the championship would look like over the next 10 years. And the line evens out. So everybody would get the same number of games, roughly, give or take 10-15%, depending on how successful you are. Obviously, you get an extra three games if you reach an All-Ireland final, two for semis and one for a quarter. That seems like a good idea. Give everybody the same number of games, and then the funding issues become more apparent. Then you can actually inject money into strength and conditioning. The Leinster Council could become really important in financing these counties to make sure that the competition equalises.
Yeah, we're probably putting it the wrong way around. It should be, the funding issues should probably be sorted before we fix structures, but fixing one or the other will definitely help.
I think that I would agree with you. It's just it's hard to identify where the funding issues are exactly if you're not in the same competition or if you don't have the same number of games. Anyway.
I think it's important, if this gets through on Saturday, and it'd be fantastic if it does, to tweak it. I do think it's important for like teams in Division 3 and 4 to win trophies. I would like to see, you know, the Sam Maguire Cup, and then I'd like to see league finals, as it were, almost for Division 3 and 4. So there's a Croke Park, big fixture at Croke Park, in front of a capacity crowd, as maybe as a double header, to give the Emlyn Mulligans, is always the example, I would say, a chance to win a trophy.
I think that
can they realistically win the Tarleton Cup? I'm not so sure.
Well, maybe, but I think that the fact that there's seven games in all the divisions, you could have a round of games which are at a neutral venue, and like we could work this out. In year two, we can all sit back down and go, oh, actually, you can have a game in Croke Park every week if you want. You can have double headers or triple headers in Croke Park every week for the 8 or 9 weeks of this. And is there a way that we can fix it? There is, isn't there?
Yeah, I do like the idea of the league final, I have to say. If you're looking at it, then you have 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in Division 1, the top team in Division 2 and the second team potentially playing the final, same in Division 3, same in Division 4, and then the bottom 16 are going into the Tarleton Cup, and there's so many games, there's so many meaningful competitions and chances to win trophies for teams.
Yeah, okay.
See, I kind of view it from a different perspective on this one, lads, where people say that this isn't an All-Ireland Championship and it's the league being played and we need to think about the league positions, and you know, not everyone gets to compete for the Sam Maguire. The truth of it is that everyone who goes into this, what is a round robin as opposed to it being the league when it becomes Championship, everyone at the very start, whether you're the bottom team in Division 4 or the top team in Division 1, is playing for the Sam Maguire and the All-Ireland Championship in theory. This is really just a qualifying mechanism for the knockout stages of the Championship, and the provincials still exist. I think there's been a little bit of a misnomer on this that, oh, we're just playing the league in the middle of the summer and some teams are going to come out of the league and compete for the Sam Maguire. Some teams won't qualify and they'll play in the Tarleton Cup. The reality is that everyone starts the season with a chance to win the main trophy.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I think that's key. And I think, because I actually never thought that this is actually the right. I think it's senior, intermediate, and junior, and that's the way it should work because it works for all the other. But anyway, but as I said, Michael Quinlan was like, oh, I need to be able to dream of winning the big thing. And fair enough. So you've got to listen to the players, and literally every team in Division 4, exactly as you've just said, at the start of the year, if they go on a Leicester style run, 1,000-1, maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. Very unlikely to happen. But like, they can dream. Anyway, we've done our bit. We'll see what happens. We're getting there now. The Magic Wall will be back tomorrow with hopefully a couple more filled in as well. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. My thanks to John King and John Duggan. Our latest Brian O'Driscoll on OTB podcast is available right now with reaction to Andy Farrell's squad announcement for the upcoming November internationals. Bod sat down with Nathan for a full breakdown of the whole team, and the entire conversation is available now exclusively on the OTB Sports app for the next 24 hours. Download it and subscribe to Brian O'Driscoll on OTB to get it first. Chief among the discussions was, of course, decisions made at out half. Here's Brian's thoughts.
Jack Carthy, yeah, has played well at the weekend for sure. Played reasonably well. Played okay in the in their loss to Dragons a couple of weeks ago. But I feel as though he's not in the reckoning with Andy Farrell, and he's going to have to be the standout number 10 in Ireland. Many people argue he's the second best 10 in Ireland on current form, and maybe they're right. But I just feel as though he's done the working backwards. Andy Farrell has from the World Cup in 2 years' time. I just don't think he sees Jack Carthy as part of a squad. Can he play his way into it? I don't know. I think a lot will have to go his way. But he's earmarked Harry Byrne, obviously. There's been a couple of false starts with him. Joey Carberry was heir to the throne, and it just hasn't quite transpired and picked up for him since his long layoff. And ultimately, you know, the captain, Johnny Sexton, is still our best number 10. So I'm not.
Jeez, I really don't want to spend another 20 minutes discussing Johnny Sexton.
We won't do Johnny. We'll pass by him.
We can assume that if Johnny Sexton's fit, he will be the starting out half against the All Blacks, which is the crucial one of these three games, yes?
You would think so. You would think so, because you've got to pick your best players. I just don't know if you can. The other thing as well, Joey Carberry has played against the All Blacks a couple of times and won. And so it's not a case that, you know, you got to give him that, you know, that sort of depth of quality opposition. He, you know, he's played in those games before. I just feel that from a confidence building point of view and from a team perspective, that you will need your best players and your best 15 against the All Blacks. And that's why I think Johnny will be picked. And then the other two will be probably, will start in each of the other two tests and then might get a half. So if you look at Joey starting against Japan, you might see, you know, Harry Byrne getting half an hour or vice versa in the Argentina game. Whereas, you know, with Johnny Sexton, what you're getting, keep him fresh for the All Black game. And then you got to select him over the course of the year in important games and pick and choose certain pinpointers of the course of the season that you feel are going to be relevant to enhancing the team and keeping Johnny Sexton happy and fresh.
Right, you can hear the full podcast exclusively for the next 24 hours on the OTB Sports app. Just subscribe to the Brian O'Driscoll pod or subscribe to the Rugby feed. You'll get it both there, and you'll hear a little bit of that on the radio later on in the week. But here's what we got on OTB Sports Radio today. OTB Gold is Mick O'Connell at 80. Our infamous interview with one of the greatest footballers of all time, where he basically smacked us around the place for about 40 minutes and had the crack with us. Live at 2 o'clock, it is The Snap. It's our American football show. Leaders' Questions is at 3. Our retro panel is Sport and The Rising. And then live on OTB Sports Radio from 5:30 tonight, Ireland versus Sweden build-up, including an interview with Vera Powell and a very special crappy quiz with Owen doing his best. Live tonight from 7 o'clock, it is Ireland versus Sweden. Kickoff is at 7 from Tala. Sweden, the second best team in the world, and the Irish women's team bidding to start their World Cup qualifier campaign with a bit of magic. Up next this morning on OTB AM, Phil Egan joins us to talk football.
OTB AM.
The news has just come through that David Fitz is going to be on the LA late tomorrow night. Good timing for Galway to get it out ahead of that.
Blockbuster stuff, isn't it?
Well, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it's quite like, because him not getting the Galway job will be particularly raw. So, like, I'm sure he's on promoting something else.
Ireland's Fittest Family.
But
it's an RTE show being promoted by an RTE show. Sure, look.
Ryan Tuberty hopefully will be well briefed on the nuances of Galway hurling.
Yeah. Again, the Loughrea caucus had your back, Davey, but it was other ones that didn't. Again, I'm making that up just in case anybody's coming in. It's 9:24 this morning. Phil Egan is with us. Phil, good morning to you. How are you?
How are you doing, lads?
Look, are we going to start with the Champions League and Cristiano Ronaldo? The Ronaldo experiment is clearly a full-blown success. This is the Thursday morning, but the morning after the Leicester game, essentially, the Leicester manager says, we knew we were going to win because Ronaldo doesn't press.
Yeah, I think one thing we always knew with Ronaldo coming in was at the end of the season, the stats will look good and there will be games where he comes up with big moments. Obviously, he's come up with the two big moments to win against Villarreal and obviously last night as well. So, you know, he's splashed all over the back pages and United will say that's where they got him. But the bigger picture, you can see exactly what Brendan Rodgers is talking about and the disappointment. So there's going to be, it pretty much epitomises United under Solskjaer. There's going to be ups and downs, and they're just box office to watch because you don't know what you're going to get. Joe, even though they were 2-0 down at half time, they created so many chances in the first half that it wasn't actually that big a surprise to me that they came back and won. And also, you know, Atalanta are not a team that are just going to shut up shop and just say, right, we've got our 2-0, we won't concede and we win the game. That's not the way they play. So I thought this going into the Leicester game as well. I thought these were games that would actually suit United because they'd have a bit of space, but there's just something not quite right there. And it really makes Sunday interesting in terms of what can Liverpool do. Liverpool, obviously, people say they didn't play that well the other night. They beat Atletico Madrid in their own backyard, not playing well. Well, that's pretty impressive. And now they go to Old Trafford, which hasn't been a good hunting ground for Klopp. They obviously won there last season. I wouldn't read too much into it. No fans there. This is a chance now on Sunday to make a statement. And unfortunately for Klopp, he just doesn't seem to really go for it when they go to Old Trafford, where I think back to three seasons ago, United had a load of injuries. The game finished nil all. And it was that game and it was the trip to Goodison Park, the 2-0 all draws there, that kind of ended up costing Liverpool when they went to the last day of the season with City. Look, people will say City winning at the Etihad in that game where Mane's chance nearly went over the line was the key result. But I just felt that day that Liverpool went to Old Trafford, Klopp was a bit too cautious. And that's not something you really associate with Klopp. So why not go for United this Sunday? And if you lose, so be it.
That's the thing, isn't it? Like, the risk, if you lose, isn't that big a deal. But actually, if you win, you set off a massive crisis at Manchester United again.
Yeah, but it also makes a statement. It makes a statement. Like, City have made statements by going to Chelsea and playing them off the park and had spells against Liverpool at Anfield where they outplayed Liverpool. So they did that in the space of a week. We're kind of wondering, what are Liverpool going to do this season? Not many people talk them up for the title. We know how good their first 11 is. We're starting to see there's a few little bumps and bruises in midfield in particular. Obviously, Fabinho's going to start. You know, Jordan Henderson's going to start. That means he's got one space. I'd be very surprised if Naby Keita started. Will James Milner be thrown in for another start? And then maybe someone like Oxlade-Chamberlain, actually, his cameo off the bench in Madrid on Tuesday wasn't bad. So Curtis Jones might be available. But that was the concern for a lot of Liverpool fans, that Wijnaldum going, that they should replace him. They didn't. And now they've a few injuries and they're just a little bit light in there.
So that might be one reason to be conservative, is that he doesn't believe he's got the personnel just yet.
Yeah, but...
But he does. I mean, he's got the best footballer in the world.
Yeah, Firmino's obviously come good again. You've got Van Dijk and Matip there. You've got two experienced fullbacks now, and you've got one of the best goalkeepers in the world. So, I mean, he's got a pretty strong hand to go to Old Trafford with. United obviously pulled it out of the bag last night. It was impressive how they came back, but you don't really know what you're going to get. But if Liverpool could start well, then they could definitely get the 3 points. I just hope it's not another boring nil-all draw.
Well, it's live on Off the Ball on Saturday at at 4:30. It's on Sunday afternoon at 4:30. Let's move on to the Saudi Arabia story around Newcastle. So they've interviewed Paulo Fonseca over Zoom. He's now the front runner to replace Steve Bruce. Roberto Martinez still being mentioned. Lampard still being mentioned. Stevie G still being mentioned for this gig. Lucien Favre and Eddie Howe. Anybody outside of that mix at the moment you think who is a realistic contender? And if you were to give me your instinct about who would actually be the best?
Yeah, I think that list covers a lot, because, I mean, we know obviously they've got huge backing now and they're going to be a serious force in a few years. But the bottom line is they're in a relegation battle. Their squad isn't great. And it's a strange one where you've got players that are basically being told now, you're going to have to fight for survival, and maybe at the end of the season, thanks very much, but now we're going to start replacing you. Now, that could work the other way, where you've got players thinking, I want to be part of this.
I might make it and my next paycheck is going to be fat.
Exactly. There will be players that are kept on, regardless of... And look, we know it can't be just a case of a demolition job where they avoid relegation and they just get rid of the whole squad and they replace it with a new one. That can't happen. That's just not possible. So there is transitional periods that have to be brought in, and maybe that's the thinking with the manager as well. So do you go for a Fonseca where he's no experience in the Premier League and, you know, what's he going to be like in a relegation scrap? Or do you go with managers that have managed in the Premier League? You mentioned Frank Lampard. He's somebody that has been in the Premier League. It wasn't the best experience for him at Chelsea. Obviously, Newcastle isn't, I was going to say, it's not as tough a job in terms of they're not expected to be challenging for titles, not yet. So maybe it would suit him. Steven Gerrard would be an interesting one because there is this thought out there that Gerrard one day will manage Liverpool. Now, I'm not sure about that. I don't know. I think whoever replaces Jurgen Klopp is in for a tough job because he's just turned the club around.
Like Shefflin, you don't want to take it.
Yeah. So who wants to be the next Liverpool manager? Does Steven Gerrard come in and say, right, maybe the Newcastle job is a chance for me to show that I can do it in the Premier League and, you know, I'm going to have a lot of money, and then maybe when Jurgen Klopp decides to leave, that, see how it's going, see do they get somebody else in on a short term, and then Gerrard might be ready. I think Liverpool fans would be interested to see if Gerrard can cut it at Premier League level, because it's one thing doing it in Scotland, and look, they obviously stopped Celtic's 10 in a row, but if you watch Rangers, they're not a great watch. They're not the most exciting team to watch, so that has to be an aspect, even in terms of Newcastle and for Liverpool.
From pure shit show, who do you want to see most?
I want to see Gerrard. I want to see what I want to see.
That's the Henry Shefflin signing for Galway arrival. You're like, wow, that's not turning away from this.
Yeah, I want to see what he's like. You know, given a load of money.
Eddie Howe knows the relegation situation, has been involved in one of those fights, understands the stresses and strains, is available for nothing. Do you get him into the end of the season and say, if you prove to us that you can do this job, we'll let you have 2 years at it?
Yeah, that mightn't be a bad one. I said, you know, he is that kind of that gap maybe before you appoint somebody more high profile to bring you to where you want to get. If Mourinho was available, he'd be nailed on for this job. I mean, he's already used the Bobby Robson line. You know, he's managing the Premier League. He would love it. But at the moment, he's doing okay with Roma. He's got a Europa Conference League game tonight, and you know, they've lost a couple of games in recent weeks, so it's going okay. But we know when things start to go bad for Jose, it happens. The snowball effect kicks in pretty quickly, and he could be available, who knows, in a few months.
Gerrard would be fascinating, wouldn't it? Really would, like, just to see it. Obviously it would be an audition of sorts for Liverpool, but just to see him can he cut the mustard at that level with a club where there's massive fair enough there's a massive bankroll, but there's a massive expectation as well.
I think there's a strong possibility that this team could go down
big, like, time. Yeah, absolutely.
The playing squad is that bad at the moment. They're that much of a rabble. The new manager comes in, signs 5-6 players. They have to go straight in the team. They have to hit the ground running. And maybe you sign Jesse Lingard and three others, and they score enough goals to keep you up, because you know that you've got players who understand what life is like in the cutting throats of the Premier League, and maybe it's not that complicated.
Yeah, there's also could be an aspect of the players weren't, Steve Bruce wasn't getting the most out of this team. So obviously Graham Jones is going to take charge for the game against Palace this weekend, and now he's fairly highly thought of. He's part of the England setup now as well. There was that spell when he came in at Newcastle, and it was clear that he was the one instructing the players tactically how to set up. So maybe the players will respond to Graham Jones and think, we like this guy, and you know, he's a bit more tactically aware than Steve Bruce. And look, that's not a dig at Steve Bruce, because Steve Bruce was the first to admit that, you know, he's happy for other members of his coaching team to set the team up tactically. And you know, being a manager is more than tactics. You obviously have to be able to manage a dressing room as well. And obviously, Steve Bruce left his mark on St Maximin. If you saw the message that he left, he spoke about Steve Bruce in glowing terms, both as a manager, but
as a man.
As a man, yeah. So, yeah, maybe we haven't seen the best out of this Newcastle team, and new manager comes in, and yeah, they start to climb up the table. Also, you have to look at there's probably three teams worse off than them. Certainly Norwich. I went for Norwich, Watford and Burnley as my three picks at the start of the season.
Sticking with that.
Yeah, I just thought Burnley, look, we know what Sean Dyche does and he usually gets them out of trouble. But I thought eventually you play with fire for long enough, you're going to get burnt. Now, I don't know if it's this season. And then when I saw them sign an Alex Cornet, I thought, that's a bit of too an exotic signing for Burnley, even though he's been quite good since he's come in. But so there is that Newcastle could just have three worse off teams than them. So they just stay up. And then next summer you see the clear out and all these new shiny signings.
All right. A quick mini deal or no deal. Thomas Tuchel has said, yeah, we would quite like to sign Haaland. Fairly unusual, I think, for this type of thing where you name check a player actually under contract somewhere else and say, oh, we could actually play with him and Lukaku together. I don't think anybody actually believes that, but we'll see. How much of a runner is this and what's your expectation about where Haaland plays football next season?
Yeah, the more I'm starting to think about it, I'm thinking Bayern Munich. And, you know, he's in Germany and he's playing for Dortmund, who they're not going to win the league. They're obviously going to finish behind Bayern. I saw Bayern again last night. They were unbelievable. They blitzed Benfica in the last 20 minutes.
And Dortmund were rubbish against Ajax.
Yeah, hammered 4-0. Now, look, I think Ajax are really good and Ten Hag is certainly a manager that could end up in the Premier League. I know he's been a name mentioned for potential Manchester United manager. But Haaland must be looking at Bayern Munich thinking, imagine all the goals it'd score for them. And you know, maybe he wants to win that Bundesliga title and then he comes over to the Premier League. But there's so many different links. Obviously, the City link, his dad played for at the moment, the Norway link with Manchester United and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. With Chelsea, it's obviously, you know, that he's going to get a good deal there as well. So they would be the three Premier League clubs. But I still think Bayern Munich, who knows where Real Madrid and Barcelona are at in a couple of years. But I'm starting to lean towards Bayern Munich because the money this summer, it wouldn't be as high.
Doable. Totally doable for everybody, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Last thing we should talk about is Ireland against Sweden tonight in Tala. The women's national team start their qualifying campaign against the second best team in the world, who have just been to an Olympic final. It's a very tall order for them to get a result tonight, but what do you expect will happen?
Yeah, I don't think they'll win. And I think Vera Pauw has always been honest about this when in the last campaign as well. Obviously, Germany were in the group and she said these are not the games you judge the team on. Now, saying that, obviously the morale-boosting win against Australia was a big deal because it ended the losing streak, which if we lose tonight, it means you're not talking about the losing streak going into the Finland game, which the Finland game is more important than the Sweden game.
Yeah.
But in one sense as well, they've obviously played friendlies against the likes of Denmark and Iceland and Belgium and they had the win against Australia. And Vera Pauw has been telling her players, these games will stand to you. So tonight we find out just exactly where Ireland are. You're playing the highest ranked team in Europe. They're obviously behind the USA in the rankings. They beat the USA 3-0 at the Olympics. Some people were shocked by it. It actually wasn't that big a surprise. They got to the Olympic final, beaten on penalties by Canada. So they're a quality team. So I think, as Vera Pauw said, by the end of tonight's game, you're going to know exactly where Ireland stand. And I just hope that we don't give away sloppy goals because that has been an Achilles heel for this Irish team in the last few campaigns, goalkeeping errors. And you think back to the Ukraine game, that was the costly one. And it's hard to keep looking back to it because you want to look forward, but it's still sore because the Euros are on next summer and Ireland won't be there. Northern Ireland showed how you beat Ukraine. We couldn't do it away from home. So, as I said, I think it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, you'd imagine she's going to go with three at the back and play Katie McCabe and Anya Gorman as the wing-backs. And I felt with the Australia game, it was a strange setup in terms of Amber Barrett was a lot deeper than we're used to. Obviously, Lucy Quinn came in, made a decent impact. Heather Payne ran her socks off. So, yeah, it would take something unbelievable to win. A draw would be an immense result. But as I said, it's all down to the Finland game. It's a really tough group.
Yeah, no, it really is. That game is live on Off the Ball on News Talk tonight from 7 o'clock with Emma Byrne and Nathan on commentary duty. Kickoff, as I said, is at 7 o'clock, and we'll be on air from 5:30 on OTB Sports Radio. Michael, thanks for coming in today. Phil, good stuff. Thanks a million for that too. More from Phil on otbsports.com today. What's your, if I was to ask for a spread on what the vote is going to be?
Oh, what a question. I'd probably be still having proposal B not to come through at the moment as a marginal favourite, but as the week has moved on, those odds have probably, if odds are shortening on proposal B.
It's tightening up.
Oh, it is big.
Too close to call, I believe, is the...
I'd say that's about... It's too close to call because you don't 100% know how people are going to vote. That's the variable, you know, because it's not...
You can say one thing and do another and no one will ever know.
Pretty much, yeah.
That works both ways.
Perfect crime, some might say.
It works both ways. If there's somebody in one of those counties in Ulster who thinks, actually, I think this is a good idea, they can always... Oh, just, did you press yes? No, I didn't.
Yeah.
No.
You'll never know, technically, even though you'd probably be able to forensically go through it after and have a fair idea, and people will be pointing fingers in certain directions if it gets through or if it doesn't get through.
Well, certainly it's under scrutiny more than it's ever been before, so we'll keep an eye on that for the rest of the week, and you'll know Saturday afternoon at some point. Good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us, Michael, today in studio.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.